Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
Big time card coming up this weekend, UFC 273, and so excited to be back and with you as always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, Matt Allen on the respective socials. Very simple, very easy. It's at Matt Allen FNP. And for the UFC's return to Jacksonville, Florida, instead of Miami, instead of Lake Tampa, we're still going to the Vistar Veterans Memorial Arena, and the fans have a big-time card to look forward to. Two title fights up at the top, the rematch in the co-main event, Aljamain Sterling take on Piotr Jan. Piotr had to go out there last year, get another win over Corey Sandhagen in an all-timer fight, and in your main event, it is the first title opportunity in quite some time for the Korean Zombie taking on Alexander Volkanovski. And littered throughout this card, a lot of gems. I mean, listen, Ian Garry in the featured prelim taking on Missouri's own Darian Weeks, looking to really play spoiler. That's just one of those fights. We have four different debuts. We have a lot of second time out type of fights. And yes, there's been some shuffles, some rebookings. But overall, Matt, this is one of those cards that should definitely deliver.
I think it should be a phenomenal card. And outside of those title fights, like Gilbert Burns is fighting Khamzat Chimaev. Chimaev might be the biggest star that doesn't have a belt in the UFC right now. I know that's a wild thing to say, but the hype that this guy has behind him is almost unlike anything we've ever seen before. Just his ability to get people out of the cage so fast, take virtually no damage whatsoever. Like, this is not seen in the sport of MMA. And the fight against Gilbert Burns, it's going to be an important one. We all know how good Gilbert is, so I'm super excited for that fight. Mackenzie Dern, Tisha Torres, another really important fight. I think this is going to be a phenomenal fight card. I know every single pay-per-view this year, they've all sort of had their own feel to them. You know, like, some of them, they're a little bit top-heavy. Some of them are more of a showcase for prospects. I feel like this card has a healthy balance of everything. You've got two great title fights at the top of the card. I know the odds are a little out of whack for those title fights, something we'll talk about a little bit later on in the video. But still, some people might be down on this card because of that, but I think there are some great fights all over this card.
And we were very lucky with, a couple of weeks ago, because there was no big UFC card. Last weekend, we had the WrestleMania, the two-night extravaganza. But when it came to the last Fight Night card, a lot of ranked fighters on this card. We actually have 12 ranked fighters, if you include the three champions. And yes, I say three champions because Piotr Jan has that interim strap included on this card. So it should be a great one. We'll throw it on over to the Fight Night Picks Fight of the Night screen. Very, very difficult throughout this card to try and pick just two. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Throw it on over to the Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
And listen, at Fight Night Picks, we hate to cherry pick off the top, but let's do it. I mean, listen, Aljamain Sterling, Piotr Jan, if you go back to their first fight, Sterling starts out hot, and then it kind of unravels a little bit as Piotr Jan downloads the game plan, plays that Floyd Mayweather game, and then he gets himself into a great opportunity. And then he throws the illegal knee, and now we're here. So ultimately, again, Jan has to go out, prove himself once more against Corey Sandhagen. Amazing fight. Aljamain Sterling's been taking pictures with the belt. A lot of people take an exception with that one, but I really don't care. So for Sterling, he's had a little bit over a year away, and he gets another big opportunity here to play spoiler defending his belt.
It's wild that that is the case, isn't it? Because a lot of people do still feel like Piotr Jan is the rightful champion of this division. And no matter who you feel like is the rightful champion right now, that's why they're going to fight this weekend, so we can all figure it out. I think this could be a phenomenal fight, because for Piotr Jan, we all know how good he is, and every fight he's been in the UFC has been a fight of the night style fight. And like you said, coming off his last one against Corey Sandhagen, it's not like he made some big change to his style and became a more boring fighter after that. No, that was another absolutely crazy barn burner type of a fight. And here's the craziest thing about Piotr Jan. He's a really smart fighter. I know the illegal knee against Aljamain might not exactly support that idea, but you know what I mean. Like you said, he downloads the game plan. He gets stronger as the fight goes. I think that's going to be really interesting to see what version of Aljo enters this fight. He was compromised or injured going into the first one, if you want to believe what he says. He had that really serious neck injury. So if we do get a better version of Aljamain Sterling showing up for this rematch, I don't know how this can't be fight of the year.
Yeah, I mean, folks have to remember, this is a guy that's 20-3. If he loses the fight, he's going nowhere. And if he wins the fight, Well, he's deserving of the opportunity. So great fight nonetheless. And listen, usually fight of the night screen doesn't include a guy who's almost a minus 1,000 favorite, but Khamzat Chimaev taking on the toughest test of his overall MMA career. I mean, he's taking on Gilbert Burns, former title challenger. You see it in the promo packs. Yes, he rocked Kamaru Usman. Yes, he was looking very good in that fight until he didn't. But for Gilbert Burns, it's been kind of a rocky road here recently. I mean, 20-4 is the overall record. You look at that loss to Kamaru Usman. Well, what does he do? I mean, on the comeback, he's taking on Wonderboy Thompson. You never know what Burns is going to look like coming off a TKO loss like that. And he looked pretty darn good, went back to his roots, utilized some of that wrestling, and that's what makes this one so much fun, because we know with Chimaev, he has that Swedish wrestling national championship pedigree to him, and he had that weird wrestling match, I guess I should say, against Jack Hermanson that happened not so long ago, but I absolutely love this fight, I can't wait for it.
There's nothing I love more than when we just figure out how good somebody who has a lot of hype behind them is. And that's the thing about Khamzat Chimaev. If you ask a regular person on the street, okay, they probably don't know who he is. But if you ask just the average MMA fan, I would say, what's your opinion of Khamzat Chimaev? You're probably going to get a wide array of answers. Of some people saying he's extremely overrated, to some other people thinking, well, he's just the uncrowned champ. He hasn't had that opportunity yet. When you're dealing with a range that wide, an opponent like Gilbert Burns is going to answer a lot of those questions for us. He's a great grappler. He's got really good stand-up. He has good cardio. He's a really well-rounded fighter. And when you're dealing with somebody who has a lot of hype like Khamzat Chimaev, you want to feed them to well-rounded fighters who are going to test them in every single area of their game. I think this is going to be a great fight no matter what the odds have it as.
Big time fights, and it's just a shame again that we had to skim the top 2 out of 3, but you let us know what you have as a possible fight of the night. Gary versus Weeks. What else? Gall versus Malat? That should be a fun one. Let us know again down in the comment section. And so it is a big time card coming up this weekend. Obviously with the two title fights, some big fights that you look at them and they make a lot of sense to be fight night main events. I mean, Aspinlad, Raquel Pennington, a couple of fighters with some of that experience. Rozenstruik versus Tybura. You have Alexei Olenek defending the crown of the 44-year-olds, taking on Jared Vandera on short notice. And Matt, we talked about the debuts. I mean, Daniel Willycat, you've got Piero Rodriguez, you got Josh Fremd, and Mike Malott as well. Again, as we said at the start of this card, and even focusing back a couple of weeks, we had a lot of success over there. Looking forward to this weekend. I mean, it's a pay-per-view card. You obviously have question mark kicks. When's that?
It's normally 2 hours before the prelims start, and I've got even better news for the fans out there, Craig. Since it is a pay-per-view, not only are we doing question mark kicks 2 hours before the fight card starts, we also do our own little commentary along with the main card. That gets started 15 minutes before the main card normally starts, just so we can, you know, introduce ourselves to the fans, start the things rolling. Normally cover, what, the last round and a half of the last fight on the prelims, sort of leading into the main card, answer any last-minute questions, and we normally just have a pretty good time talking about the main card of fights.
Should be a great time. Coming up this Saturday, really appreciate everybody for tuning in. We have a full packed slate of fights coming up that you're not going to want to miss, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. You're in Brazil. It's a Saturday morning. You're watching cartoons. You're watching Thundercat when all of a sudden Willycat appears on your television screen. Now, coming up this weekend, it could either be Willycat Daniel Santos or the aforementioned cartoon character. And we have Daniel Santos making his, I guess I should say, long-awaited UFC debut, taking on a true veteran of the sport in Tiger Schulman's own Julio Arce. And this is one of those fights that I look at it, and style for style, this one should be a lot of fun. Because if you've ever watched a Willycat fight, and I suggest that you do. Now, you're going to go out there and you're going to search it, you can't complain and say, oh, I couldn't find tape on this guy. I really couldn't find tape. Because you either search Daniel Santos or you search Daniel Willycat. And it's going to be one of those two. And they're out there. A lot on YouTube, a little bit on Fight TV, a little bit on the Twitter and the Facebooks of the world. This guy is an absolute monster. I mean, he's like a Tasmanian devil if there were a cartoon character. Comparison, if there was a comparison in baseball, the guy fights like Dan Uggla hit in 2010. All forearms, all power, and all very tight and compact and in close. And the craziest part about Daniel Santos is this guy, of his 10 wins, 3 of them, just throwing that spinning stuff. Because I don't like to curse on the channel, you know, with the YouTubes and as it goes. But when you look at Daniel Santos, Matt, this guy is an absolute ball of fire. And he's either going to sink impressively in the UFC, or he will swim from, I don't know, like France to England in the English Channel.
Going back and watching Willie Cat's regional fights is a lot like watching Zion in high school and in college. You almost can't believe the stuff that he's getting away with. It's like, wow, he's able to do this? And it is. It's spinning back kicks to the body, spinning back fists. He does have a really unique style where he can be technical down the middle with a lot of his attacks, but he also can get wild. And when I say wild, you might think that there's a negative connotation with that, but there isn't. Like, wild in a positive way. There's sort of a sustained wildness to Santos's game that I really do appreciate. But like you said, anytime we do have these press aspects about this eye-catching talent who do have these sort of trademark finishes, if you will, on the regional scene, those are the type of people who do seem to flare out in one or two fights at the UFC level. So we'll be really interested to see how far can Santos get, because for Julio Arce, it's weird. I feel like we've been singing Julio Arce's praises for a very long time. He's a much better fighter than I think the average MMA fan would assume. So it's really strange that they're giving Willie Cat Arce as his UFC debut, because I know Arce might not win against every fighter he's ever gone up against, but his level of competition is much, much, much higher. And he's a very active fighter, too, and that's the interesting thing with Santos making his way over to the UFC. Will he be able to get away with such athletic moves at this level, where he is going to have to conserve his energy quite a bit more, especially against a guy like Arce, who, defensively, he might leave some holes open, and if you are a really powerful striker, you will be able to hit him. Will you be able to finish him? That's another conversation, because he does have a fairly good chin. I know he got finished by, what, Song Yadong in his last fight? I don't care about that at all. That's one of the best fighters in the world. So I do think with Arce, this is one of those moments where people are probably more down on him than they should be. And that's why I'm somewhat surprised that Willie Cat's getting him as his UFC debut.
Yeah, this fight doesn't make much sense. I mean, for Daniel Santos, he's been away from a cage in general for 2 years and 3 months. He took on a very interesting test, I should say, in Nizambek Junusov over with Brave CF. And he gets an armbar win. And when you go back and you watch that fight, they clinch, and then he just kind of throws him backwards, scrambles to the back, and he's able to get the submission win. If you go back and you watch some of these fights against Enrique Fantini, Fantini's having a lot of success at the start of that fight. It's a lot of straight shots down the middle, and Santos just kind of eats him. His head's popping back like a Pez dispenser, and then Fantini hits a wall. And if you look at Fantini's record, it is a winning record, but then you look at who he beat on the regional scene, and it's a lot of computer code. It's zeros and ones, and that's pretty much it. Fantini drops off at about the 2-minute mark, and then Santos finally starts to pull through. Craziest part about it is he has one of those spinning body kicks or spinning back kicks to the body, and it's his heel that hits the liver from tight proximity, too. Like, he doesn't really do it with a ton of flair. He does it with a ton of speed, and it's very, very effective. And when you look at Daniel Santos, he comes out of Shoot the Box, Diego Lima. You see it in a lot of the pictures. Charles Oliveira. You've got Thomas Almeida.
Great gym down there.
You've got Alon Nascimento that looks bigger than all of those guys, which is kind of crazy. He's got a fight that was just booked. But I look at this, and I look at all of the fights. I mean, Santos has decent takedown defense. Again, you can go back and watch his fights with either ACA or ACB. The fight against Astemirov was one of those ones that was kind of close, because when it was standing, Santos is winning the fight, but he gets taken down quite a bit in that fight. The one thing that I did actually like out of it was he gets taken down, and as soon as he's down, he's trying to work his way back to the fence, work his way back up to his feet, and 9 times out of 10, he doesn't just get ground out on the mat. It's something that you do like to see, but I want to give one comparison before I hand it off to you, because again, takedown defense for Julio Arce, legendary. I mean, Andre Yule, Arosa, the Tamor fights, those are all finishes, but you look at it. I mean, the only guys that have tried to take Julio Arce down, Dan Ige went 1 of 13 on takedown attempts, and you also had Tamor, one of the two Tamor brothers, go 0 of 2. But for Santos, again, I look at this guy, and I kind of liken him to Daniel Lacerda that made his debut at 125 not that long ago. Flash and flare, good wins on the regional scene. And when he came to the UFC, a little bit of flash and flare, he got taken down, and that was kind of it.
This is my one big thing with Santos, and you might disagree, you might agree. I don't have a good read on him because it's been 2 years since he's fought. Like, yes, I like a lot of the film, and I like a lot of the tape that I have watched. But when you do go back and watch a lot of his grappling exchanges, they are from fights 3 and 4 years ago, and that really does matter. So there's a version out there where we see a similar version of Santos this weekend walk into the octagon, but there's also a world where he is a much improved fighter since the last few times that we've seen him, because he is only 27, and that's been a big point as of lately that we really like to bring up. The UFC's been sort of not minor leagueifying the UFC, but we both like baseball, Craig. We understand how the world works.
We're bringing in a lot of replacement
exactly.
players over 30.
In baseball, if you're not really good, a team's not going to pay you any money because they can find somebody younger than you are and they can pay that person as little as they really need to and they can keep their overall payroll very low. The UFC does a similar thing sometimes with some of these fighters, and that's why we see some prospects, if you will, later on into their career. Santos still is a fairly young guy. I know he's 27. It might be a little bit older than some prospects, but he just turned 27. And his last professional fight, he was 24 years old. Like, this is the thing I'm trying to get across. My hair was shorter than Craig's the last time he had an MMA fight. I do think there's a world out there where Santos could be a much more improved version of himself, but it's going to be very difficult to say, wow, his first fight, he's ready to fight someone like Julio Arce, who at one point was in that like 15 to 20 range, and maybe he's fallen off a little bit from there. I do think speed-wise, he will have a little bit of trouble, especially on the feet, because with Arce, he is a phenomenal striker. He does have very, very nice technique, but the speed with some guys can get on the inside has always been a bit of an issue for him. Now, with Santos, he's someone who will fight at range quite a bit. And that's why I think this fight, on the feet, I could see it being very, very 50-50. I'm curious to see when Santos does decide to go for a takedown attempt. Because I do think that if this fight gets on the inside, if they do start to clinch a little bit, Santos does like to go for some of those, like, knee-tap, kind of trip takedowns on the inside. Like you said, Arce is not impossible to take down. But unless you have a very, very high-level wrestling background, it's going to be difficult to take someone like Arce down, who's just really good at digging for underhooks. And he's a very physical guy, especially at this late class.
If you look at it for Julio Arce, co-owner of Tiger Schulman's, I didn't know that. I read that in an article from the New York Post and Scott Fontana, you know, friend of the show over on Twitter. So if you do look at this one, the last point I have about Santos before we talk about the odds, for Santos in 2016, he was booked to fight Adrian Yanez at Legacy FC 50. Then that fight fell out a month later. They were scheduled to fight at Bellator 149, again, with a different promotion. That fight fell out. Bellator 149, Matt, do you remember the card? It was, of course, Shamrock versus Gracie and Kimbo Slice versus Dada 5000. So when we look at the odds for this one at open, Julio Arce minus 160. He's now a minus 197 average on best fight odds. For Santos, open plus 140. He is at a plus 164. And if we have a look at the Tapology vote, surprise to us is there to you. Matt, when somebody's around a minus 200 on Tapology, I usually set the over-under at around 70. I'm going to say 72.5%. What do you say, over-under?
I'll say over.
You're going to say over? It is over. What is that? Oh my. 1,614 total votes. 81% Arce, 73% say by decision, 17% by knockout. For the 19% that have Santos, 43% by decision, 34% by knockout. So Matt, we talked a lot about Daniel Santos. We haven't talked a ton about Julio Arce. But again, if you look at it for Arce, bread and butter, really long combinations.
Incredible kicks.
A lot of power and very, very good kicks mixed in with great defensive wrestling. So I look at it for Arce, a lot of positives there. For Santos, definitely the speed, definitely has good power, definitely unorthodox takedowns, and very interesting jiu-jitsu. But when it comes to breaking this one down, again, a little bit of unknown from Santos as to the whereabouts in the last 2.5 years. And I should mention, he was booked to fight a couple of different times last year, and it's really important to note the two names that he was booked against. Timur Valiev, and then Marcelo Rojo.
Not so, scrubs by any means.
No, one of them's had a bad run in the
but
UFC.
But still, even Rojo, it's not an easy fight to go against him. You're going to eat some big shots. We're going to learn quite a bit about you, I'd say.
That much is true, and sometimes Rojo will say negative things in an Instagram post about Deiveson Figueiredo. But when it comes to this fight, Matt, and we look at this one, I have Julio Arce in this, but in terms of confidence on the overall card, this one wouldn't be the one where I plant my flag.
I like Arce a good amount in this fight, if I'm being honest. If you're making your UFC debut after a 2.5 year layoff against somebody who we thought should have been ranked not that long ago, like, there's quite a few things stacked against you at this point. For Julio Arce, again, I know he didn't look good against Song Yadong. Most people don't, if we're all being honest, though, and I truly think Song Yadong's, I'm going to say it right now, future champ Song Yadong. I know we said that for Brandon Moreno for a long time, and he was eventually able to capture that title. I truly do think Song is in that category of the elite at this weight class. For Arce, stylistically, he just keeps everything a lot more straight than Santos. And Santos does have big power. He could land some crazy head kick, and it's all over Twitter. But for Arce, If he can stay up the middle, use his leg kicks, and just work from the leg to the body to the head. And I know that's a big ask. It's the first fight on the card. Normally, we don't talk about fighters in this position doing this types of techniques. But for our say, we had high expectations for him at one point. And I do feel like that fighter that we once saw is still sort of in there. It's been really tough matchmaking for him in the UFC.
And we'll have to see how he makes out on this continued run at 135 pounds. Not one of those cuts that gets any easier as you get up into your 30s. Only 32 right now. But time will tell how that move will play out for Arce. So an interesting fight coming up this weekend. Both of us going with the man himself, Julio Arce, to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments who you have. The always exciting Willy Cat, Daniel Santos. No entry for that one on Urban Dictionary yet, but that is an egregious and aggressive nickname. Taking on Arce out of Showmans and a big time card coming up, including two title fights, one in this division in the co-main event and in the main event at 145 pounds, Volkanovski, Korean Zombie. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, two young prospects trending in opposite directions. We have the UFC debut of Venezuela's own La Fiera Piera Rodriguez taking on Kay Hansen. And for Kay Hansen, Matt, coming into the UFC, a lot of people had lofty expectations. I mean, she was very, very young in her overall MMA career. And even still, she's only 22. Like, that's the craziest part about it. Now, I understand, again, the record, it's 7-5. It's not that hot. In her last two fights, both of those losses, she won her UFC debut against Jinyu Frye. And in that fight, she wasn't really able to get the takedowns going until it got into the later stages of the fight. She really turned it on. She looked very good. Performance of the night bonus in that submission, and it's a victory that's kind of aged quite well. I mean, Frye's really been able to turn it around for herself in the UFC, even at the later stages of her career. But if we look at it for Kay Hansen, and we touched on this not that long ago, because her last fight against Jasmine Jazdevicius, the Canadian making her debut, was about a month ago. So if you look at it, Kay Hansen goes out there, fights Corey McKenna. That fight, I want to make sure, was a year and 3 months ago. And you go and watch that one. Really, really close. Very, very controversial. Just like Corey McKenna's last fight against Elise Reed, where we're going, wait, a judge had that 30-27 for McKenna? Like, what are we saying? But overall, the judges in that fight, if you look at it, there were three 29-28s for Corey McKenna. MMA decisions, two 29-28 McKenna, 11 29-28 Hansen, and three had at 30-27 Hansen. Again, we talked about this a month ago. I thought Kay Hansen won that fight. A month later, I still think she won that fight. But that doesn't matter, because for Kay Hansen, her last time out, she has a fight. It's at 125. It's against the former Canadian freestyle wrestling champ and Jasmine Jazdevicius out of Ontario. And when you watch that fight, Kay Hansen can't get the takedown going. Jazdevicius is much bigger, much more imposing, and is able to really rock off those longer shots from distance, whereas Kay Hansen just can't figure out that distance management.
And that's why I'm going to bring up an April Wine lyric right now.
Oh, boy.
So don't take your time, it's getting late. We might lose if we hesitate. That's the thing with Kay Hansen. There's a certain hesitancy to her game that I don't really understand, because we know where her bread gets buttered. It's in her grappling. And she might not be the most aesthetically pleasing grappler in the UFC, but when you look at, okay, what's her significant skill set? I would say it's her ground and pound, it's her top position. It's just her overall, I would say, physical package with her top game, especially in MMA. But I know you've got some stats to bring up about her overall takedowns completely in the UFC, and that is a very big issue.
So I have two things that just don't gel. So in the UFC, Kay Hansen, again, came in with a lot of hype. Like, people had lofty goals and expectations set for Hansen. She gets a win over...
And just to back that up, like, it's not often you see people around 20 make their UFC debut. Like, Song Yadong was one who came into the UFC at 19, and he was able to start off running. Most of the time, there are, like, Sage Northcutts, though, and Kay Hansen, like, it's always interesting to see who can rise to the top and genuinely be one of those young fighters who comes in their teens and really is able to set up their career, and some fighters, we just never see the improvement.
So Hansen takes on Jinyu Frye. She's a minus 225 favorite. Then she takes on Corey McKenna. She's a minus 200 favorite. Then she goes out for her last fight, taking on Jasmine Jazdevicius, and she's a minus 190 favorite. Like, we're talking minus 200 just about every single fight. And where we're talking about where Kay Hansen is great at, again, the commentary might talk about her boxing. She had a not-so-great boxing career in 2019, an 0-2 record there, but when it comes to her overall MMA game, it's a takedown. She's 5 of 23 in her takedowns total in the UFC, and Corey McKenna is a good grappler. And Jasmine Jazvisius up a weight class is a pretty darn good wrestler. And Jinyu Fry is a pretty good grappler. I wouldn't say wrestler, but grappler when it comes to her jiu-jitsu game, it is very, very high level. And it's kind of translated to strawweight because, again, she's more of an atomweight. But for Kay Hansen, that X-Factor skill, we just haven't really been able to see it shine through. Now, it could shine through in this matchup. Piera Rodriguez is not a grappler. Piera is a striker to the nth degree. And I went through and I watched her fights. And obviously, she trains at Black House. And you see some of those training partners. Sabina Mazel when she's there and she's not across the country training at Teixeira's MMA and Fitness. How crazy is it talking about that gym a lot now? But it's with Tabitha Ricci, who definitely has those grappling credentials. And then she also kind of changed camps in the last number of months. She spent some time at All-Stars. Obviously, we have Hamzat Chimaev on this card, but Mandy Boehm is somebody that's in one of these lower weight class divisions. It's somebody to train with there, as well as Elin Oberg. But Matt, when I look at it for Piera Rodriguez, I mean, you go back, you do the tape study, a lot of fun when it comes to striking. Tons and tons and tons of power. And she's one of those kind of run and gun type of fighters that you really, really like to see, especially coming into this division, because we don't have a lot of knockout artists at 115. Piera Rodriguez, even though if you look at her last two fights, the fight for the title over with Alafea against Svetlana Gutsik, and then the fight against Valeska Machado, she didn't get the knockout against Machado, but she really did have a lot of success in that fight and showed a more well-rounded skill set too.
And I thought her cardio looked really good in that fight too, which is going to be a big point against Kay Hansen, because again, early on in this fight, Hansen, let's just break down what Hansen is good at. We talked about her wrestling, we talked about her grappling. She herself does have good cardio. That's something that does have to be brought up. She tends to get stronger as the fight goes on. But against someone like Rodriguez, it will be interesting where the cutoff line is as to when Hansen can start to take over with her cardio and with her pressure. Because for Rodriguez, I expect her to have a lot of success early on with her striking. Hansen's never really improved that part of her game at the UFC level yet. It's interesting. Kay Hansen isn't someone like an Evan Mobley who just showed up onto the scene and you're like, wow, that person's sort of ready for the big time. Hansen to me is almost like a Robert Williams where you're like, what the heck is going on right now? And then you hope that they can sort of put it all together. Now, Robert Williams was able to put it all together and that man is an absolute monster on a basketball court. With Kay Hansen, the parts are there. It's just a matter of putting them all together. And she is still very young, so she's going to have a lot of time to do it. But at 7-5 at the strawweight and flyweight weight class, not two weight classes that we normally look at and say, wow, these are the deepest in the world. It's just not a great sign for a young prospect. And I do think that's something that has to be brought up. And with Rodriguez and her striking background, I genuinely believe that even though she does have five less MMA fights, her striking is a big enough factor to where it almost adds that extra experience factor in for her. Kay Hansen, and I'm glad you brought up her previous boxing experience, is not a good boxer whatsoever. She doesn't have any volume-finding tools on the feet to really accumulate any type of volume to win rounds. So unless she's able to get a takedown early in the second and early in the third and just control the whole entire round on top, I don't know how she's going to be able to win rounds.
So we should say this for Piera Rodriguez, because again, Venezuela by way of then Spain, she's been training at Black House for her last number of fights, the LFA fight, the fight on Dana White's Contender Series. She was a big, big favorite in that Dana White's Contender Series fight, like a minus 425 favorite against Machado. And again, she gets the win, all three judges, 29-28. She was able to mix in, like I said, it was a complete skill set because we got to see a little bit of her wrestling, but little bit of a sketchy level of competition even going into that fight on LFA. She did look very, very good in that one. Again, Svetlana Gutsik looks like a little bit like if you mixed Chloe Grace Moretz and then Ronda Rousey. If you merge those two people together, you get Svetlana Gutsik.
I don't know who the first one is.
Who from, what's the movie? Jeez, now this is bad. Kick-Ass. She's in Kick-Ass.
Okay. Strange name, but I know who you mean now.
Nicolas Cage.
It just took me a minute.
And if you really do watch Piera Rodriguez in that fight, she really does go at it, pushes a good pace. The one troubling thing is she's got a really cracking right hand. She'll leave it out there, and then she'll bring it back and keep her right hand really low. She's susceptible to that left counter. And the trouble was, Gutsik, once she landed it once, she was able to just continue to land it. You didn't really see much of an improvement or much of a change out of Rodriguez to try and really match that or defend it
so
all that
Manofio
well.
So Manofio keeps Rodriguez up at night is what we're saying.
That's what we're saying, even though they're in two totally different weight classes. The other thing with Rodriguez is, before that fight, she makes the walkout, and I had to Shazam the walkout song. She walks out to Slipknot's Wet and Bleed song, so that's pretty cool. You like to see that?
so aggressive.
Dedication, it really is. But again, I look at this, Piera Rodriguez, very much a striker, very much a boxer. She'll mix in a bit of a kick, but she boxes. Kay Hansen, complete skill set, giant favorite in all of her other fights. Again, around a minus 200. When we look at this fight, Matt, a little bit of a surprise. Odds open to par. Rodriguez now a minus 136 on best fight odds for Kay Hansen, plus 112. And if we have a look at the Tapology votes, surprise to us there, to you. Honest to goodness, I have no idea what they're going to do. I'm not even going to guess. Look at that. So 1,629 total votes, 74%. For the debuting fighter, 84% by decision. For the 26% that have Hansen, 71% by decision. Matt, what say you?
Okay, this is one of those fights, and I think we can both agree on this. We're going to look dumb no matter what we say. Either Rodriguez goes out there, looks like the second coming of Jeff Neal at 115 pounds, knocks out Kay Hansen, we're like, oh my god, what are we doing? Or Hansen goes out there, works just sort of one of those classic, gets you up against the cage, go for a takedown, rinse and repeat takedown style kind of a fight, and she looks great doing it. For me, I am going to slightly side with Rodriguez, and I know it's weird, because normally in MMA, if you have two people who one relies heavily on their striking and one relies heavily on their grappling, well, the sport is sort of sided towards the grappler. But I don't think Hansen's going to be able to shoot takedowns from very far away against Rodriguez, and I do think she's going to have to do that in this fight. I think up close and in the striking, Hansen is going to eat quite a bit of damage, because that's the thing about Hansen. She has never really been able to improve her striking to where she's added like a new component to it. Brian Ortega's whole MMA career took off when he added elbows to his game, and I know that's a big thing to add to your game, but Ortega was a really good boxer, but guys would get into his range and he didn't have a way to deal with that. So he fought Frankie Edgar, showed off his elbows, and now he shows them off in every single fight. And when we think about Brian Ortega, we don't just think about the striking and the jiu-jitsu, we think about his elbows too. If Hansen could add some type of a weapon like that to really make use of her range and her inside fighting, I think it would open up her takedown attempts quite a bit. I just don't think she has that wrinkle to her game, and that's why I'm picking Rodriguez.
It really is tricky because Gutsik, again, her level of competition before the LFA, she was a pretty big favorite in that fight. And when you go and you watch it, she doesn't really go for many takedowns. She tries to pull guard. She's a big armbar fighter. Again, the Ronda Rousey comp, and she's not able to get it. And Rodriguez is able to go out there, tag her, also take a lot of damage. If you look at it in the Machado fight, again, a complete skill set. But I definitely don't see Rodriguez taking down Kay Hansen in this fight. I really like Piera Rodriguez for the striking component, but again, this is only, what, her third camp in a row at Black House, training with Tabitha Ricci, training with Mackenzie Dern, who's also on this card. I'm going to take Kay Hansen in this fight, but again, you touched on it. The fact that you're either going to look really smart or really dumb. In this spot, I look at it, Kay Hansen's been around a minus 200 favorite in three UFC fights. She's 1-2, although I thought she won that McKenna fight. I'll take her as an underdog in this spot against somebody who hasn't been proven against the UFC level. So actually, Matt, they opened at par. Piera Rodriguez, minus 136 okay. Right now. Kay Hansen, plus 112. So in this opportunity, I'm going with the American and Kay Hansen, Matt. You're going with Venezuela's Piera Rodriguez.
This is my problem. And again, I'm going to get a big eye roll out of Craig here. I never, like, Kay Hansen to me wasn't even a standout talent in Invicta. And that's why I was kind of surprised she got so much hype coming into the UFC. I know she's young and I know she does have a long ways to go. But when you're talking about young fighters, normally they add multiple parts to their game every single fight. Whereas Kay Hansen had a year off in between her two last fights, and she looked like the exact same fighter, if not worse, in between those two performances.
Well, Matt, we'll see if the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu blue belt for Piera Rodriguez shows out. She has amateur boxing and K1 experience. Big opportunity. Split on the pick. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this big-time strawweight fight at the bottom of the prelims. Big-time card coming up that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say, let's get into it. The middleweight roller coaster of bookings and rebookings comes up this weekend, and it gives us this fight between Fluffy Hernandez, Alexander Hernandez, taking on Pittsburgh's own, by then way of Colorado, Josh Fremd. And if you look at this fight for Fremd making his UFC debut, it's a big time opportunity. Obviously, he was involved not that long ago in the middleweight four-man tournament for that LFA middleweight belt. He ends up getting the win over Bruno Oliveira, who was not that far removed from his fight against Carlos Ahlberg on Dana White's Contender Series. He drops him fairly easily. It's kind of an odd punch that drops Oliveira. Almost looked like a jab, really, was what it was. It drops Oliveira. Fremd able to get the win. Then he goes out there and he takes on Gregory Rodriguez, and he does not win that fight. He gets blitzed, and it really was a bad timeout. So for Fremd, He gets the opportunity, he comes back, he has a couple of more fights, he was featured on Dana White's Looking for a Fight in his last time out, and really put on some very, very good performances, and I want to make sure that I give them the credit that they deserve. He's able to beat Renato Valente over with LFA, he gets the win over Joel Bowman his last time out in that fight. On Looking for a Fight, Bowman fought a terrible, terrible fight. I want to say that one right out the gate. I mean, Bowman went out there swinging for the absolute fences. He was really trying to hit home runs, and that was pretty much it. He had the skinniest chicken legs I've ever seen, and I say that being a
you
person
own a mirror, Craig.
That has skinny, skinny chicken legs. So I'm not necessarily making fun of him as I am myself, but when I went and I watched that fight, it really was. Bowman just went out there from the start, whiffing the hardest shots he could, trying to put Josh Fremd out. Because we've seen Fremd, even in the Valente fight, get cracked and get wobbled a little bit. So he gets wobbled a little bit against Valente. He's able to get the win there. Against Bowman, he ends up getting the win. And if you go and you watch that fight, the sneakiest thing about Josh Fremd that I noticed, he is a meat and potatoes type of fighter. He fights with the very, very specific, very, very technical game plans. And you see him implement them. Once he's able to figure out distance with his jab, it's over. He's just going to spam you with that jab. He makes the fight relatively boring, but he also has a little bit of snap on that, a little bit of snap on his right hand when he decides to throw it. He throws some leg kicks just to switch things up. But the craziest part about it for Josh Fremd, he spent a little bit of time wrestling in D3, and that's interesting because when he decides in most fights, and I wouldn't say in this fight, but when he decides he wants to wrestle and he wants to get that top control, it just adds that extra layer of depth to the game plan of Josh Fremd.
I 100% agree. And in his last loss too, which you had brought up, I'd much rather a guy loses to Gregory Rodriguez, someone who we all know, than just lose to someone on the regional scene that we never heard of
in
the first.
It was bad, though.
I know it was bad, but again, we're talking about a good fighter who beat him. We're not talking about someone who's 0-1 who knocked him out really bad. So I would much rather him lose to a recognizable name, although it was bad, than, again, lose to someone who's just like a career regional fighter. For Fremd, it will be really interesting because I do think he's the better striker. And like you said, when he is able to find his jab and his range, he really does open up the totality of his game. But he's someone who is getting hit clean quite a bit in every single one of his fights. And I almost bring up like Dillian White. Like Dillian White's a really, really good boxer and he's going to fight Tyson Fury for the title. But in every Dillian White fight, there's that one moment that you think he's going to get flatlined. And sometimes he does get flatlined. But he's always hurt at least at some point throughout his fight. I'm curious to see when Fremd does start fighting better strikers in this division because, let's be honest, Anthony Hernandez isn't the type of guy who's going to be able to exploit every hole in your striking defense. He can strike on the feet for sure, but he's not someone who you will look at who's progressively learning throughout their fight, finding holes as they go. I don't think he's going to have a lot of success on the feet, at least early on in this fight. I think it's going to be interesting once Josh finds his range and sort of settles into the fight, because that's when I think he's more susceptible to getting hit himself. Because when he does start to settle into the fight, it's sort of robotic. And that's the thing that I always go back to with Fremd and his striking style. It is very, it's just sort of similar across the board no matter what time the fight's at. So it's going to be very interesting if he starts out having success. Because I think if he starts out having success, we can sort of expect the fight to maintain the similar flow throughout it. But I think that if Hernandez is A, able to get a takedown at any point throughout this fight, he is that good of a grappler. And I think he's been able to show that throughout his UFC tenure to where you do not want to mess around with Anthony Hernandez on the mat. I'm just really curious to see, how is Hernandez going to get Fremd's respect on the feet, especially early?
A little bit of an overreaction, I don't know. I mean, you look at it, when Hernandez is taking on a poor grappler, he's able to get the wins. Now, again, Rodolfo Vieira is different. Because
I just don't mess with it, though.
Rodolfo had a ton of success in the first round. In the second round, fell off a cliff cardio-wise. And the thing that makes that win even more sweeter is the fact that Hernandez broke his right hand at the start of that fight, kept throwing it, and beats Rodolfo Vieira, the black belt hunter, submits him for the first time in MMA, with a broken hand. So if you look at it for Hernandez, I talked about bookings and rebookings. There was a fight that was supposed to happen with Duraev this weekend. That one fell out. He's supposed to take on Dricus du Plessis, a ranked opponent. That one fell out. Du Plessis was supposed to Kelvin Gastelum. Gastelum, I am compromised, so that fight's not going to happen. But you go from those guys, and I consider Duraev like on the cusp, and he's only had one UFC fight where he himself did get cracked. But Albert Duraev is a mother effer. And Josh Fremd's not Duraev in the aggressiveness and the way that they fight. Josh Fremd, again, like I said, a little meat and potatoes, but it really does get the job done. Before that, though, Hernandez was supposed to take on Dustin Stoyfus back in December, and he was supposed to take on Puna Soriano back in June of last year. The hand was still an issue, so that fight didn't take place. So Hernandez has been on the shelf since that Vieira fight for just over a year. But again, if you look at it in from Dana White's Contender Series 5 fights ago to now, fights Jordan Wright, and he does what you need to do to beat Jordan Wright. Crashes distance, throws power shots, drops them, finishes them. Disgusting knockout where Wright's head's there, and then he keeps punching it. It was really, really bad. Then he comes into the UFC and he loses to Marcus Perez, where Perez takes him down and Perez submits him with an anaconda choke. He goes out there and fights Jun Young Park. I love a Jun Young Park fight. Beats him by submission. Loses to Kevin Holland, where again, that fight was kind of in Hernandez range, in tight. Holland was able to get the clinch, throw the knee up the middle. Hernandez drops. He loses his win. He gets beat in that fight. And that was kind of near the start of the Kevin Holland 2020 here we go train. And then Hernandez, again, gets that win his last time out. So Matt, again, I look at this one for Hernandez, a main training partner, Max Griffin. He's a black belt in the Marinoble MMA style, whatever the F that means. Like, I don't know if that's like Bok Fu. That's, Max Griffin's black belt. But it is kind of weird that way. Hanging out with Griffin and Jamal Emmers over on the Instagram. And when I look at this one, again, for both of these guys, a lot of experience, if you will. For Hernandez, 9-1 as an amateur, 8-2 with a no contest due to the weed against Jordan Wright. But for all intents and purposes, a giant knockout win. So, Matt, when we look at this fight, Hernandez open a minus 150 favorite. He's a minus 185 right now. For Josh Fremd on best fight odds, open plus 130. He is a plus 155. If we have a look at the Tapology vote, surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Anthony Hernandez. See how hard it is?
It is. It's very difficult. I'll say slightly over.
I'm going to say slightly over. Ooh, it's slightly under. 1,212 total votes. 74% Hernandez. 30% by decision. 51% by submission. 12% by knockout. Really wish we got that Puna Soriano fight now that we're talking about it. For the 26% that I've Fremd, 30% by decision, 55% by knockout. Josh Fremd is a very good fighter. I think if he wins this fight, it'll be by decision, not by knockout, which deviates away from what the fans have said. Again, I look at it. He does have power. He does have zest and pop at the end of his shots. When you crowd distance, he gets hit and he drops his right hand a lot. I talked about that with the Piera Rodriguez fight taking on Kay Hansen. But Josh Fremd is very susceptible. He can make the changes in his fights, but he does drop his right hand a lot. And he takes these long, long periods between his strikes on his resets. Anthony Hernandez is a fast twitch guy with a lot of power. So on the feet, I give Fremd the advantage. Again, in technical striking and power, I give it to Hernandez. And when it comes to the grappling, wrestling, probably close. I might even give Fremd the edge. But when it comes to overall grappling, Anthony Hernandez with the submission ability, his black belt in Marinoble's martial arts.
I just couldn't imagine Josh Fremd's coach right before this fight being like, hey.
Being Mark Montoya.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine Mark Montoya, who's an extremely smart head coach, being like, you know what we should do against Anthony Hernandez? We should probably shoot a double leg 5 seconds into it. I don't expect him to wrestle very much against Hernandez just because the submission threat of Hernandez, especially with his defensive submissions on the back foot. It will be interesting because I think Hernandez is more likely to win by knockout early and submission later, just because that's sort of the style of his fight. If it does become more of a grindier fight, he can fall back on his grappling prowess. And then we realize just how good of a submission threat he is. With Fremd, I think he is going to have a lot of success, at least early on, with his distance management in this fight. I think the first 3 minutes, we're going to be sweating and we're going to be really nervous about Hernandez. But I do think that every minute that goes by, Hernandez is going to be able to get a little bit closer, and a little bit closer, and a little bit closer. And that's not only going to help him with his striking ability, that's going to help him with his own takedowns if he does decide to go for them. So, for me, I do slightly side Hernandez, but this is a weird fight because Hernandez has some very key strengths. He also has some weaknesses in his game, too, that someone who is well-rounded like Fremd could take advantage of. So I think this is a very fun fight, but I am ever so slightly favoring Fluffy.
Big-time opportunity for Josh Fremd coming in on short notice to get the win. He wasn't able to get that LFA middleweight title against Gregory Rodriguez. Anthony Hernandez, the real McCoy. He got that win over Brendan Allen, and then he was able to punch his ticket to Dana White's Contender Series. So a big-time opportunity for both of these guys. For both of these guys, we're going with Anthony Hernandez in this fight. You let us know down below who you got. Is it Hernandez out of California? Is it Josh Fremd, the transplant to Colorado? Big-time card coming up this weekend. Two title fights at the top you're not going to want to miss. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Before the UFC, Jared Vandera, former EFC heavyweight champion, was known as the Mountain. You can see that on every moniker. Hell, it's even still on Tapology. And for Jared Vandera, an interesting stat about him, he's going to be taking on the former middleweight, Alexei Olenek, a man who fought Chael Sonnen at that division. Craziest part about it, though, for Olenek, typically weighs in around the 225-230 mark. For Jared Vandera in the UFC, he's had four fights, and the craziest part about it is you look at the fights that he's had, and they were all very, very recent. Only one of those fights has he weighed less than 265, and it was a fight against Justin Taffa where he weighed, you guessed it, 264. Jared Vandera, one of the biggest guys you're going to find in this division. The record is 12-7. The record in the UFC is 1-3. He is very much a throwback to yesteryear in the heavyweight division. He reminds me a lot of an Anthony Hamilton. We're talking Freight Train. We're talking like the guys from, I would even say like 2008 to 2010. Like you got to weigh as much as you can. You got to have a wrestling advantage over most guys, but not the upper echelon of the division. You can pump a jab, and if you need to, you can throw an over hand right. And for Jared Vandera,
so wait, is Jared Vandera to MMA what Luke Voigt is to MLB right now? Just a bit of a throwback. Not the flashiest guy, but
a lot of chonk.
Yeah, there's just some GM from the 1960s who would look at these types of players and be like, yes, that's who I want on my team.
The guy's a man. The guy's a dude. He can really bang. So for Jared Vandera, realistically, when you look at it, he even trains at a throwback camp. Like, you don't see many people coming out of Team Quest anymore, but that is where you do get Jared Vandera, a guy whose profile pictures amuse me. They do. I mean, his little smile and wave. It's just like that old Headstone song.
This is the weird thing about this fight. I don't know if you're about to hand it off to me
I just want to say this, though. The weirdest part about it is we talked extensively about Alexei Olenek, his 14 Ezekiel choke wins, the fact that he's going for win number 60, the fact that the man's not hot lately, but he was supposed to fight, well, not last week, it was 2 weeks ago, against Alir Latifi. Then they rebooked the fight to this week, and now, I want to make sure I mention it, on March 31st, this fight was announced, Vandera stepping in on short notice to take on Olenek.
And I know we were both oddly excited about Alir Latifi versus Alexei Olenek, so it is unfortunate that that fight did follow, because that's sort of a weird, fun fight, if we're all being honest. Alir's been around for a while, same thing for the Boa Constrictor. Just for Jared Vandera, like, I say this a lot on this channel about how, like, you know, like, if Giannis decided to do MMA and not basketball growing up, he'd probably be the best at this sport. I'm just here to say it. And if he figured out how to play football, like, he's such a good athlete, he'd probably be able to figure out how to make the NFL. I don't look at Jared Vandera and Alexei Olenek and throw that same level of athleticism onto these types of professional athletes. Because for Vandera, he is very steady for this weight class, and it's odd. You don't normally look at a guy who weighs 265 pounds and say, wow, his strength is cardio. But I would say definitely in this matchup, but really against most guys in the heavyweight division, he's at least steady throughout a lot of his fights. And again, it's not the level of activity of someone like a Max Holloway who's going to go out there and really wow you with their shots. But they can at least stay consistent throughout a 15-minute fight. And at the heavyweight division, that's a lot, honestly. Like, there's not a ton of fighters we can talk about and say, wow, cardio is a strength of theirs. And that's why this fight, oddly enough, is kind of fun. Because we're going to figure out, where does skill and size sort of not matter anymore? Because I think Alexei Olenek is by far the more skilled fighter in this fight. When it gets to the mat, there's not even an argument. These guys are in different stratospheres. They're in different universes when it comes to their grappling ability. On the feet, though, even, I think Alexei Olenek's as technical as Jared Vandera. Like, Olenek's MMA striking isn't that bad. He was able to outstrike Fabricio Verdum, who's a way better striker than Jared Vandera. He was able to outstrike Travis Brown, who, again, wasn't at a good stage of his career when he did that. I'm just saying, I don't think Alexei Olenek on the feet is so far behind Jared Vandera that, wow, I'm going to worry about him every second he's standing. On the mat, I think he's way better than Vandera. It's just, when does age and when does size really do matter? Because for me, I think Olenek is the more skilled guy. It's just when you look at how much smaller he's going to be and just how much older he is than Jared Vandera, it really does worry me about what shots he's going to be able to eat on the feet, especially early.
So I'm going to go to like a weird left field, like maybe even a high porch, but a short left field. Maybe we're going to Fenway and we're talking about the Green Monster. So UFC 271 featured prelim. They wanted you to pay for the pay-per-view to see Bobby Green beat Nazareth Hackpress with Jared Vandera and Andrei Arlovsky. And we watched that fight. It was actually on, well, not even the late stage of the Fight Companion or the Fight Night Pick Sidekick, as we call them here. If you watch that fight, which we did, and we covered it with the fans, you can go back and watch our reaction. I thought Jared Vander won that fight. And it's
not a hill I die on either way, because it wasn't good.
It's somewhat controversial. I went back. I still believe in that. So the judges scored it. Robert Alexander scored round two and round three Vandera. Douglas Crosby and Jeff Rexrode scored it 29-28 for Arlovski. MMA Decision 16 had it 29-28 Arlovski. Two of them had it 30-27 Arlovski. So nobody scored it for Vandera. I thought Vandera forward pressure. He had better output as well. I thought he won the fight, but he didn't win the fight. So I look at Vandera. I look at his other fight against Justin Toffa, where again, it was just walking forward, lots of volume, able to get the win there. He loses to Romanov. That was going to happen. He loses to Spivak in his debut, where he called out Spivak and then he got taken down and beaten up. But Alexei Olenek also got beaten by Sergei Spivak in his last fight. But it was a completely different fight. Sergei Spivak looked like K1 Mark Hunt Spivak. He looked amazing. Olenek, again, people were down on Spivak after that fight because he didn't finish Olenek. I was high on Spivak. I thought Spivak looked great. I thought Olenek looked quite poor. So the weirdest part for Olenek coming into this fight, again, he is 44. Best stretch of his career from late 2013 to 2018. He has a first-round neck crank win over Mirko Krokop to book his ticket to the UFC. Then he goes 6-2 in the UFC in that span. Six of those wins, all of them, by finish. And if you look at it, his best performance, probably the Travis Brown one where he knocks him down and then submits him.
It was
something
really nice.
I never thought I would say. His worst performance, I mean, again,
we'll be here for a while if we're going to list them all.
From 2019 to 2021. So he went 6-2. Then 2019 to 2021, he goes 2-5. Four of those five losses are by finish. Worst performance? The Wald Harris one where he gets finished really early. I think it's a Spivak one, his last time out. Like, it's just all Spivak. Olenek can't take him down. Olenek can't bait him into, like, an Ezekiel or, an Emmanuel Sanchez-esque standing submission against the cage. So, really, when I look at it for Olenek, again, he had that win over Fabrizio Werdum. That one was by split decision. It was somewhat controversial, but Werdum was coming off of the layoff.
Most people thought Olenek won, though.
His striking looked very bad. And then he has that win over Maurice Greene, but some people call me Maurice, just did not have a good run in the UFC. So, again, Matt, Vandera's taking this fight on very short notice. We're talking about 10 days. Olenek was due to take on Ilir Latifi, who was working his boxing with Francis Ngannou, wearing his Carmelo Anthony jersey. Go look at that one. But when we talk about the odds for this one, Olenek opened a minus 135. He's a minus 105 right now. Jared Vandera opened a plus 115. He's a minus 115. If we have a look at the short notice topology votes, Matt, I'm going to say over and under 60% Vandera.
I think Olenek will be the favorite.
Olenek is the favorite. 990 total votes. We have 78% Olenek, 83% by submission for the 22% that have Vandera, 65% by knockout. Craziest part about it for Vandera, knockout artist on the regional scene, we have not seen that same knockout ability, or at least the ability to get guys down to the mat and finish them from on top, where we had seen that out of Vandera coming into the UFC.
Gonna knock anyone out, though. It's gonna be a 44 going on 45-year-old Alexei Olenek. This is my problem. If Olenek was 39, he mops the floor with Jared Vandera. But the problem is that Father Time is undefeated. He's gonna catch up to you eventually. Sarah McMahon is an outlier, okay? He had his grasp around her, but she was able to get away. For Olenek, he was able to escape Father Time for later than most. He was able to make it into his 40s. But his past few fights, he looks like a shell of the fighter he used to be. He doesn't have the explosion to get a lot of takedowns. And since he doesn't have that explosion to secure takedowns, it is a lot of him just being a sitting duck on the feet. And I know I talked about his striking, and I don't think it is terrible, but it is a lot of looping shots. And when you're fighting someone like Vandera, who is more down the middle than Olenek is, because for you to be more down the middle than Olenek, it's not a big accomplishment. Like, they are sort of these windmill-type shots that come from weird angles, and that's why I do think Olenek does have the success on the feet that he does. It's not because he's a great technician. It's just because he is so unique and sort of obscure on the feet that he throws those weird Ben Askren against Damian Maia uppercuts. He's very
Marge
big.
Marge Simpson uppercuts.
Well, no, Marge Simpson's like a big Justin Gaethje one. I'm thinking little rabbit punches. Almost the opposite. For Olenek, though, I think he's the much more skilled fighter, but at 44, I just don't think he can demonstrate the skills that he has memorized, if that's a good way of breaking it down. So I think Olenek's the better fighter, but I just think size and youth on Vandera's side is really going to play out. I know he took this on short notice, but I don't see a world where Olenek's able to secure a takedown early in the fight, and unless he is able to, I don't think he's going to be able to win.
Olenek was able to look pretty good in the first round a year and 7 months ago against Derek Lewis. Derek Lewis is a lot better than Jared Vandera, so we'll see what happens this weekend. I have Vandera with the fact that he has youth on his side and size on his side, but my goodness, I can definitely envision a world where Alexei Olenek goes out there like Paul Craig and just ends up submitting him because Jared Vandera makes mistakes, just like Nikita Krylov. So a big-time opportunity for both of these guys coming up this weekend. Oddly enough, both of us going with the short-notice guy in California's own Jared Vandera to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. It's the guy going for his 60th pro win in Alexei Olenek. Is it going to be Vandera? Big-time card coming up this weekend. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. From 10-0 in a Fight Night co-main event slot to buried on the prelims, we have big-time Olympian Mark Madsen, and he's taking on Vince From Hell Pichel in an interesting fight in the lightweight division, because if you consider this fight overall and you want to play a little bit of a game, you add the ages up between these guys, and we're up there. We are really up there. You have 39-year-old Pichel, you have 37-year-old Mark Madsen. I get it. Even as an Olympian, he was an older guy competing. He was able to get that one done. Silver medalist in freestyle wrestling. But when you look at it for Madsen, I say it's kind of odd because he was in a co-main event slot. There was a lot of attention.
In his home country, though, where he won an Olympic medal. That's why he was so far up on the card.
But there was a big-time opportunity for him his last time out, taking on Clay Guida. That card taking place over in Las Vegas. That one with Cannoneer and Gastelum as a main event. But if you do look at it for Madsen, he takes on the Carpenter. And in that fight, I don't know if, like, fight ready, they're whispering in his ear, have your Khabib versus Sal Iaquinta performance. But Mark Madsen only went for one takedown attempt up against the cage, albeit Clay Guida's squirrely. Doesn't matter if he's 25 or 45. Clay Guida's one of those guys. He's always moving, pitter-patter, throwing a lot of volume.
Just a lot of that hair.
His hair breaks out in about the end of the first round. And if you do look at it for Guida, great defensive hips, really good takedown defense, really good offensive takedowns when he's a better wrestler. But Guida in that fight showed us a classic Guida performance. Didn't really get his chin checked. He was able to really kind of bust up Madsen from the outside, and Madsen just walked him down. And the thing that I noticed out of Madsen in that fight, because it's been a buzzsaw for Madsen in the UFC, he finishes Danilo Belluardo in his UFC debut, looked really good in that fight. He fights Austin Hubbard, looks really good at the start of that fight, able to get the decision win there. And against Guida, it's a split decision win for Madsen. I watched that fight, and I honestly had a hard time scoring the rounds. It was that close. It really was. And I looked at it, like, one championship-wise, I looked at the total of the fight, and I thought, okay, Madsen walked him down, Madsen fought behind the jab, Madsen won the fight to me, but it was a tough one to score. Round by round, it really was. So I look at this one. It was originally scheduled to take place at UFC 271. They rescheduled the booking between these two guys, but again, Madsen, we know, wrestler. The best one, maybe.
He's extremely limited in his MMA skill set, though.
Kind of like Mike Grundy. And you saw Mike Grundy. Again, Mike Grundy's last time out against Makwan Amirkhani, really extenuating circumstances. Father, terminal illness there in front of him. You know, we're fighting at home in England. He goes in there, quickly goes for a takedown, gets submitted by Amirkhani in a defensive submission. That could happen to Madsen. Vince Pichel is a tricky, tricky fighter because he's from California. He's trained in California for a long time. Late career switch over to Factory X. He had the guys and Mark Montoya and crew in his corners last time out. Beats Austin Hubbard. Looked really good with his striking. Really crisp. Great kicks to the body. Good combinations to the head with his boxing. Long range attacks. Switching stances as well. If you look at it, his fight against Jim Miller. Even against Hubbard. Gets taken down. And I'll talk about those takedowns a bit. Gets taken down by Jim Miller. And in the Roosevelt-Robert fight, too, he's just so physically imposing when it hits the mat that he's able to reverse these positions. I don't know if he's going to be able to do it against Madsen, but hell, I don't know if Madsen's even going to wrestle in this fight because I didn't see him do it in his last fight.
I also don't know if Roberts was ever really UFC caliber. He had a lot of hype, but anyways. The weird thing about Marco Madsen is, and I've had people come at me in my DMs over this, I've been about 20% lower on him than I think the consensus MMA fan has been, because even going into the Hubbard fight and the Guida fight, like, there's a lot of holes in his game, and the more you start watching MMA, you care less about people's strengths and you focus more on their weaknesses, because 9 times out of 10, if you're going to lose a fight, you're going to lose it in the same way that you've lost it before. Like, people have these weaknesses, and then other people will watch that fight, and then they realize, hey, I can take advantage of these holes too. We've seen Madsen run into a bit of a roadblock where it's okay, you're still having success, but it's not just wrestling has become an issue for you. Now we throw cardio on top of it. Now we throw on top the fact that, well, you're not the greatest submission threat once it does hit the ground. So if you do get a takedown, the fight's probably not going to be over immediately once you do secure it. And if you're not able to just hold the guy down, get into that really heavy half guard or full mount position, your ground and pound is not really of the level of someone like an Islam Makhachev who can just go out there, hold you down, make you feel their presence, and then they can get the finish. So Madsen, to me, especially when he's fighting these, and I don't even look at Paischel as a borderline ranked fighter, but when he's fighting, I would say, top 25 up guys, well, those people aren't just sort of one-trick ponies, and he is going to have a really hard time against people who can offer more than just initial takedown defense and some striking. And I know this fight against Paischel is sort of the Hubbard fight, but leveled up a little bit, because what's Hubbard good at? He's good at defending takedowns, or at least later on in the fights. He has pretty good volume, and he's a good rangy striker on the feet. Paischel shares a lot of those same attributes, but Paischel has much more power, I would say, than a guy like Hubbard, and he has far less kicks, too. The thing that I've always struggled with Paischel is, and you had mentioned it, he doesn't have great takedown defense, but he's not a bad grappler by any means. So I'm going to be very curious to see if he is able to have any wrestling success against Madsen, or if he decides to initiate any scrambles. Because for Madsen, like you had said, he wasn't wrestling heavy at all in his last fight against Guida, but I would think that that has more to do with his opponent than anything. Because like you said, Guida's just so squirrely. He's always doing something. And if you do waste your energy wrestling a guy like Guida early on, then we know Guida's going to be able to come back strong in that second and third round. So I do think we will see a more grappling-heavy version of Madsen. I'm just curious if Paischel can have any success on those in-betweens, especially up against the cage. Because in the middle of the mat, I don't think he will have any success whatsoever. But in the cage, Paischel's the guy who, he's been in a lot of fights against a lot of top guys. I'm curious to see if he'll have any success in those areas.
Going to the Walmart frozen food section for that. And when we look at it for Vince Paischel, if you really do look at the way that he fights, when he's up against the cage, decent elbows, decent abilities to kind of get out of that clinch or at least reverse position. He's another one of those guys. Again, it's going to sound silly because for Mark Madsen, you look at it, you look at the wrestling, so on and so forth. Greco-Roman, if I said freestyle before, that was a mistake by me. But Mark Madsen is one of those guys with the Greco-Roman base. It's going to be a lot of throws and a lot of upper body strength. For Vince Paischel, he's one of those guys, a lot of upper body strength. Poor takedown defense in the UFC. It's at a 25% mark. You got to look at the ways that he's getting taken down. So again, his last time out there, you're taking on a guy in Austin Hubbard, and you get taken down four different times. And I want to mention how it happens. First round, again, he's throwing kicks, and the kicks are getting grabbed, and he's getting taken down. He gets taken down by a single leg. It's a lot of different things that Madsen might be able to initiate the takedown off of those things, but it's not one of those things where, you know, a Greco-Roman guy is going to think, oh, I'm going to grab a leg kick and take him down. It's not to say that Madsen can't do it. It's just not one of those things that you see all that often.
Greco-Roman's very trip-heavy, though, and if he catches a kick, that's going to open up all those trips. So I genuinely think Greco-Roman is going to help him a lot in this, because this thing with Madsen, again, he doesn't have much submission ability. His ground and pound isn't great, but his wrestling is going to be able to win him rounds at the UFC level, and that's been able to carry him so far. I genuinely look at this fight the same way I looked at the Hubbard fight. Madsen's going to have success until he doesn't. I'm just wondering where the sort of fall-off begins as to when Paischel's going to start to have a lot of success.
It'll be interesting to see, too, how Madsen makes out with another camp at Fight Ready. Obviously, in the main event, you have the Korean Zombie who's made the move over there. Since he's come back into MMA, I mean, I think from the Bermudez fight on, he's at Eddie Cha in his corner. For Madsen, second time out there, big time opportunity. Obviously, Coach Henry Cejudo loves to pump up his fighters and have weird fighter pillows at his house. I find that very odd. For Paischel, though, I definitely give him the advantage with the striking. Much more dynamic guy. Has a lot more pop at the end of his shots. But again, it comes down to, when does Mark Madsen wrestle? Will he decide to wrestle? Let's see what happens coming up in this one. So if we look at the odds for this fight, Paischel open as the underdog, plus 130s, minus 137 over on that site. If we look at it for Madsen, open to minus 120s, plus 113. If we have a look at the total Tapology votes, Matt, surprise to us, they are to you. I know Madsen's the underdog, and he opened as a favorite, but I'm going to say Madsen over under 65%.
I think it'll be slightly over.
And it is over. 1,677 total votes, 72% Madsen, 81% by decision. For the 28% that have Vince Paischel, 78% by decision. So people seeing this one going by way of decision. For Vince Paischel, he hasn't finished a fight in some time. I know he has a really deceiving record in the UFC. It's kind of crazy. 7-2 in the UFC. Lost to Rustam Khabilov in the debut. The only other loss is to Gregor Gillespie. His last finish win was over Damian Brown, who never had a boring fight back in 2017. So again, a lot of fun there. For Pichel, he's been tested in his last two fights with the grappling against Miller and against Hubbard. He's passed those tests, but can he do it this weekend, Matt? What's the pick here?
I think Mark Madsen's going to be able to win this fight. Again, I don't love the overall well-roundedness of his game. He really is only a wrestler coming into the octagon 9 times out of 10. His striking has shown slight improvements, I will say. But at 37, how much more can you really expect out of him, especially on the feet? He's going to reach a point where his striking does catch up somewhat to his wrestling. But if we expect Mark Madsen to ever get into the rankings and start fighting top-tier guys, he's got to get to work really soon and start becoming a lot more active. With Pichel, You kind of mentioned it for me. You did my work for me. He's not a great finisher. If he had more finishing ability, I would maybe start to side towards him. But Pichel, in my mind at least, is going to have to go out there, really rally in the second round, and really rally in the third round to have a lot of success. He could do that against someone like Mark Madsen, but I do think the wrestling of Madsen is going to at least even their cardio a little bit as this fight goes on. And that's why I have Madsen ever so slightly. But I'm going to end it on this. I won't be sold on Mark Madsen as a contender, even if he beats Pichel. Even if he beats him by first round ground and pound. He's fought a lot of these similar fighters. Like Clay Guida, Austin Hubbard, and Vince Pichel are all kind of in the same category. Like, they can offer a fun fight to anybody on any given night, but we don't look at these fighters and think, wow, they're going to break into the top 25, top 20, top 15. So Madsen, I think, needs a serious step up in competition if he is able to beat Pichel, but I think he will be able to this weekend.
Combined age of 76 between these two men, Mako and Flaky on the crest with Vince Pichel and picking Mark Madsen. For me, again, I look at this fight from Madsen's last time out. Fought behind a jab, threw a few right hands. John Anik touched on it, and then the rest of the commentary kind of piled on to the fact that Mark Madsen, when he strikes, he'll throw his right hand, dip his head out, and leave it there to the left. And even when he's thinking about striking, he dips his head to the left all the time. Vince Pichel throws hooks a lot. And for Pichel, his last time out against Hubbard, he had him rocked at multiple different occasions. The trouble for Pichel, he fights just like Brian Barberina. In striking and in takedown defense, Barberina, a strong gust of wind to his leg, and he's dropped right down. Like, his takedown defense is porous.
And it's weird because he looks like he's trying really hard, but you're right.
And so does Vince Pichel in that Hubbard fight. He defends the first takedown really well up against the cage, bucks him off, keeps going, throws a kick. You push his leg and he falls down. And especially as the fight goes on, it goes that way. I like Pichel striking a lot more. And for me, I have to go with him in this fight. It is a tough one to try and get because, again, this is another one of those ones. It's going to be Mark Madsen just grinding the heck out of him. Or Madsen does what he did his last time out, strikes a little bit, and I think he's not going to have much success in that. So we're split on the pick here. Matt going with Denmark's Olympian, Mark Madsen. I'm going with Vince Pichel in this one. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Are you with the Tapology voters? Are you with the odds? It's going to be an interesting fight nonetheless. Two big title fights at the end of this card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend at welterweight, we have a man that had consecutive wins over Chick Magnet Punk and Sage Northcutt taking on Team Alpha Male's own proper Mike Malott, representing Burlington, Ontario, Canada. He moved to go to school at Dalhousie. Boo, the Tigers suck. Go Reds. Go UNB. Let's go. But he went over to Dalhousie, became the head Muay Thai coach at Titans MMA. You know Titans. We know Titans. Gavin Tucker's gym. He was supposed to be on this card taking on Pat Sabatini, but that fight didn't happen. You can see how I get excited about East Coast MMA. But for Malott, really started his early beginnings as a professional mixed martial artist there. He had a fight against Hakeem Dawodu over with World Series. He has had bouts of inactivity. But realistically, if you look at it from Mike Malott, Matt, and you go over to the Team Alpha Male website, because we've seen him cornering some fighters. We saw the blurb before Dana White's Contender Series, but if you see the blurb on their website, it says for Mike Malott, he is the MMA, BJJ, and Muay Thai coach. What do you do when you see the bout sheet come across and you get that? Like, how do you handle that? The guy's a thrice coach over Team Alpha Male.
Just decline and give the UFC the contract back. This guy must be a killer.
This guy's wild. And for Mike Malott, obviously, the inactivity is a little bit of a concern. He had the loss to Hakeem Dawodu. That's his fifth to last fight. 7 years and 5 months ago, Hakeem Dawodu, like steel over with World Series, just cutting through everybody. Just a very dependable buzzsaw. And then he takes on Danny Henry, and it did not go that well. But for Mike Malott, has that fight, fights Tomas Danye over with Bellator 6 years and 6 months ago, fights Craig Shintani 5 years and a month ago, then a long period of inactivity. Goes to Team Alpha Male, he's a coach, he's in the room. Everybody talks about Mike Malott and how good of a striker and how good of a technician he is. So for Mike, Oddly enough, he fights with CFFC against Solomon Renfro and on the commentary team, a former foe of Mickey Gall in Chick Magnet Punk. And Chick Magnet's talking about Mike Malott and how good his striking is and how good of a technician is. Mike Malott didn't look very good in that fight. Until he did. I mean, he throws a straight shot, drops Renfro, goes, just jumps to his back, no hooks. He's able to get the rear naked in, then he gets the hooks in, and then he's able to get the win over Renfro. But man, Mike Malott got rocked by combinations. Renfro kept crashing distance, and every time he did, made him pay. The best shot that Renfro had, he went 1-2-3 to the body, and then as Malott ducks to turn away, Renfro throws a left hook. It drops Malott, and then he gets back up, and Renfro continues to pour on the damage, lets off the gas a little bit. It's just one straight shot. Renfro drops down, and Malott's able to capitalize. And then over on Dana White's Contender Series this past year in 2021, he takes on Szymon Szmatryski. He's able to get the win. Szymon Szmatryski was very early on in his career, but Malott did look very, very good in that fight, dragging him down, getting the submission win. For Malott, though, again, we touched on it. Jiu-Jitsu coach, Muay Thai coach, MMA coach, over with Team Alpha Male. It is an interesting mix. It's a cosmic gumbo, if you will, that Mike Malott possesses to take on Mickey Gall.
But MMA is one of these few sports that makes zero sense whatsoever. And 9 times out of 10, the fighter is not equal to the sum of their parts. And that's sort of what I'm worried about with Mike Malott coming over to the UFC. Because when we talk about what his accolades are and what his skills really are, I really focus on the stand-up more than his grappling ability. And especially in this matchup against someone like Mickey Gall, who is a phenomenal grappler, especially with his offensive submission game, it's probably not the fight you want to show off how good you are at grappling. And with Gall, it's interesting. I don't have a great read on Mickey Gall, and here's the great news. Nobody does. If anyone tells you they know exactly what Mickey Gall is going to do, they're a full-blown liar, and you should never listen to what they have to say. Because for Gall, he came into the UFC so green in his career that we didn't really know what we were going to get. He has a great personality, called out CM Punk on the regional scene. It's a money grab. Let's see what we can do. But after that whole, you know, event, let's call it, is over, where do you go from there? Now you're a signed fighter in the UFC. You can't go back and fight amateur once you're a professional. So for Mickey Gall, he flew too close to the sun.
The horse was
honest.
Before the cart.
It exactly was. And it was really unfortunate because for Gall, he has the personality.
The cart was before the horse.
He has the personality, and he does have some of the skills, or at least the foundation of what a really promising MMA fighter could be. But the issue is that he just kept on fighting guys who were either way below him or way above him in the rankings, and we never really got a good idea as to, okay, who is Mickey Gall's equal? Because we all knew Randy Brown was better than Mickey Gall. We didn't really need those two guys to fight to prove that point. But I definitely thought Gall was better than Diego Sanchez. It's like, okay, well, that's not the case either. But he beat George Sullivan, a guy who, if you're watching this video, y'all probably have no idea who that is. He had a few fights
King
in the UFC.
King of the Cage, great, George
King
Sullivan.
King of the Cage, great. But it was a tough run in the UFC, if we're all being honest. And Gall went out there and completely destroyed him. So we know you're better than George Sullivan, but worse than Diego Sanchez. How wide is that pool of fighters is what we're asking ourselves. And Gall has made improvements throughout his career. But the thing about his improvements is that they've never been the type of improvements that synergize to his Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He still isn't a great wrestler, which is something I worry about. He has good boxing and improving boxing, but it's still very basic. And that's something that really is going to have troubles for him because he's not a great striker at range. So if you have good kicks, you can beat up Mickey Gall from far away. And if he does get close to his opponent, he's not the best wrestler in the world. So it's sort of like defending a pick and roll when you know the guy isn't a shooter. It's just eliminating like half the equation from your brain. You know if Mickey Gall's going to get in close, he's either going to clinch or try to box you. He's not going to go for traditional style wrestling takedowns unless your name's CM Punk and he can just do it at the start of a fight. So I just think for Gall, he was put in one of the worst situations in UFC history. I really do believe this because if you looked at his foundation and if he didn't get that opportunity against CM Punk, he would have probably had like kind of a Bilal Muhammad career trajectory. If you look at Bilal Muhammad's career and his resume, he had a fight in Bellator, he had a fight in this scene, he had a fight over here and over there, but he was able to slowly build himself up and become a well-rounded fighter in the UFC. I just don't think Gall was given that time to sort of incubate and cook over time outside the UFC, and we've never really seen the version that we deserve it at this stage.
Mickey Gall trained with Joe Schilling for the longest time, and I was expecting those improvements, and then I never saw them. Then Mickey Gall went and trained at Immortal Martial Arts with Matt Brown, and then all of a sudden he comes out and fights Jordan Williams, and he looks like Naaman Gracie against Mark Leminger. And if you don't remember that fight, I'm going to reference that again later on in this card.
Man, it was Muay Thai, right?
Mackenzie Dern when she takes on Tisha Torres. But if you look at Naaman Gracie when he fights Mark Leminger, it's like, holy crap. Like, Naaman's been a less than stellar striker in all of his MMA fights because he's been with Bellator and World Series. And then all of a sudden against Mark Leminger, who's a good wrestler but a pretty good striker, Naaman's Bangkok ready. We're Jorge Gurgel. We're looking really good. So then Naaman goes out and fights Logan Storley, and Logan Storley looks like he's the boxer. Well, for Mickey Gall to relay that, he fights Jordan Williams. Jordan Williams, striker. Mickey Gall had laser striking in that fight. Like, I can't undersell it, and I won't undersell it, but I don't want to oversell it, but he did really look good. He had Jordan Williams on wobbly legs multiple times. He's able to get the fight down. He's able to submit him in that one. He looked really, really good. And then his next time out, he fights Alex Morono. And listen, straight up, Alex Morono, if you don't know him, because you should, because he's fought Anthony Pettis, and he's fought Donald Cerrone.
And knocked out cowboy.
Knocked out cowboy. Alex Morono has a Taekwondo base and a Jiu-Jitsu base. And he's really hard to beat because he has good volume. He has good power. Kinda he's good on the ground. Very well-rounded. In that fight, Alex Morono drops Mickey Gall. He's able to really just have his way with him, not get taken down, and win a decided unanimous decision. So again, I look at it for Gall. It really is tough. He has a new podcast with Gerard Michaels, so that's cool. The GMMG podcast or MGGM podcast. That's kind of fun. But when I look at it for his opponent in this fight, Mike Malott, 2009 national light contact kickboxing champion. He was also able to get worlds after that in 2009. No-gi champion in multiple different jiu-jitsu competitions. And you see that out of him. Muay Thai boxing and jiu-jitsu coach over at Team Alpha Male. The last Team Alpha Male that coach that we had really make a run in the UFC. No, I'm not talking about Danny Castillo, who only yells when he's in the corner of every fight. But it was Alexander Munoz, and he has not looked good in the UFC. I know he's a wrestling coach with Team Alpha Male. There was a little bit of hype there because he actually is a good power puncher, but he hasn't looked great in the UFC. From Malott, what I've seen, because I throw out the fights that he's had 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, good to see, but also those fights were at featherweight and lightweight, and he is a welterweight now. So again, this is where it's going to pay out. Mickey Gall wasn't really ever the biggest guy at 170, but he's kind of filled out his frame of late.
That's a very good point to bring up.
Mike Malott, size-wise, again, has filled out his frame as well. Again, it's been from featherweight to welterweight, but he really does look like a welterweight at this point.
And I'm really glad you bring up that point about Mickey Gall, because this is a horse that I fed until it died. Because Mickey Gall talked about, oh, I'm going to move down to 155. It's something I could do. You're huge for 170, or at least now you are. And even back then, it was weird, too. Like, that was leading into the Diego Sanchez fight. He was like, oh, maybe I could go down to 155. Then he had an awful weight cut to make 170. His cardio failed him in that fight, and he got knocked out, and he decided, hey, I'm not going to make that weight cut. It's just, with Mickey Gall, there's always an oh, by the way, no matter what it is. And I'm just not a big fan of that at this stage of his career. It reminds me a lot of, like, Chris Duarte at the start of this NBA season. People were fired up about Chris Duarte. If you're not from Indiana, you probably have no idea who he is, but he was the front runner for Rookie of the Year like 10 games into the season. That's kind of like Mickey Gall. He was the front runner. Everybody liked him to start out. But once we started to see a little bit more tape, the holes started to become more apparent, and we did start to notice some weaknesses in his game, similar to Chris Duarte. So for Gall, it's unfortunate because anytime you say anything about somebody who has any level of hype behind them, it's sort of like the Patty Pimblett. No matter what you say, be it positive or negative, it's going to get blown out of proportion. But for Mickey Gall, I just don't think he is the striker that he showed in the Williams fight. I do think that fight was a bit of an outlier because Williams was so worried about the overall grappling of Gall. I think Gall's going to have some success with his boxing if he can get on the inside of Malott. But I can see Mike Malott having a lot of success if he's able to stay on his back foot and use a lot of his front kicks because that's one of his better techniques. He's got a great teep to the body, a great teep, even up high if he decides to go to the head with it. And I think that's a technique that would be really good to at least keep Gall off of him. Because the thing with Gall is that he likes his boxing, he likes his jiu-jitsu. You need to get close to your opponent if you do want to employ those two areas of your game. And I think at kicking range, Gall is going to have a lot of trouble with Malott.
Malott, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, black belt in that Smatrisky fight. Smatrisky goes for a lazy takedown. Malott just pulls on that guillotine and cranks it. He's able to roll. He's able to get the win there. 39 seconds. It was quick. If we look at the odds for this fight, Mickey Gall open a plus a 120 underdog, now at a plus 165. For Mike Malott, open to minus 140. He's minus 200 right now. Looking at Tapology, the votes are a surprise to us there to you, but I'm going to say the fan favorite, Mickey Gall, over under 65%, Matt.
I'll say under.
You're going to say under. Ooh, look at that. 664 total votes, 66% Malott, 64% by decision. For the 34% that have Gall, 49% by decision, 38% by submission. Gall, it is interesting to note, We've seen him lately out of Sanford MMA. He's put together this fun partnership with Jason Jackson, and I love it.
So, great fighter.
Really, really fun stuff there, but an interesting fight nonetheless. Again, Matt, when we go for the pick, who do you got here?
Well, Jason Jackson would definitely beat Mike Malott. I think that's something I can quite comfortably
say. I'd
love
to see it.
He's so good. Here's the thing. Everything says Mickey Gall should probably win this fight. You have a fighter making their debut. They haven't been all that active as of late. I think that's fair to say about Malott. When we have to go, what, 7.5 years
yeah,
ago?
Yeah, two fights really quick where he's come back into it, and he's looked good in the way that he's won.
Exactly. But my big point is, especially with this fight, is how long will it take Gall to get it down to the mat? Because I know Malott has a black belt in jiu-jitsu. I don't think he's as good of a grappler as Mickey Gall. Mickey Gall was one of these guys who, he was a brown belt, but he was able to submit black belts in true jiu-jitsu competitions. So you can't always just look at their rank and determine, oh wow, this guy's a better grappler than that guy. I do think Mike Malott will have success on his back foot throughout the majority of the first half of this fight. But you had sort of brought it up. Malott does struggle when guys get on the inside of his kicking range and his punching range. He's really good at that, like, sort of Goldilocks zone where it's not all the way on the outside, it's not all the way on the inside. It's just when he's able to dictate pace at the longer range. I think Gall's going to really struggle with that early on in the fight, but I do think that as the fight progresses, we can see Gall get closer and closer and closer. I just don't know if he's going to be able to do anything once he does get the fight close, and honestly, that's why I'm picking Mike Malott.
Mike Malott, super speedy hands, great 1-2, really good teeps down the middle. If you look at it again, I mean, he's got a brother, you know, Jeff with the Manitoba Moose. 20 goals on the season. Jeff, let's go.
Pretty good season, right?
Out of 52 games, yeah. Not bad. I mean, if you want to make the Jets aren't having a great year. It's been sad for old Winnipeg. But Matt, when I look at this fight for Mike Malott, again, he's trying to end Mickey Gall's Randy Marco streak because it's alternating wins and losses in his last 7 fights. You could say it's a Charles Rosa streak too. But I look at it for Gall, again, if he's able to box his way in and not accept the leg kicks, which is easier said than done, I think he'll have a lot of success. For Mike Malott, great at jiu-jitsu, great at technical striking. It's a really tough ask to beat a guy like Malott for Mickey Gall. I think Gall's going to do it. As an underdog, as a plus 165, I'm going to take the shot and go with Mickey Gall. But again, would I be all that surprised if Mike Malott comes in here and he's that guy that beats Mickey Gall? Not necessarily, but for Malott, I don't know who the hell you match him up with after this. I really don't.
Honestly, the same thing can be said for both. If Gall loses this fight, he's probably fighting in Bellator. Like, it's over for Mickey Gall if he can't beat Mike Malott. It really is. Like, Gall didn't have hype like a Khamzat or like a Shavkat Rakhmonov, where you look at them and you think, wow, they could be a future champion, they just haven't had those opportunities yet. He was more in that kind of money fight world, you know? It was the entertainment that was really carrying him more than his skill set was early on. But in the sport of MMA, we really only care about your personality when you're at the top of the card fighting for belts. And for Mickey Gall, he hasn't been able to get enough success to where he is in the rankings, where he is getting a lot of these like media opportunities that would let him fully take advantage of his personality. It's just been really unfortunate that Gall's had the career that he has, because I was a really big fan early on. I really thought he was going to go on to do great things in the sport, but I do have Mike Malott this weekend.
Tougher fight to call than most. Matt going with the Canadian Mike Malott out of Burlington, Ontario. I'm going with Mickey Gall representing New Jersey. Big time fight coming up this weekend. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. We have 2 title fights up at the top that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. At one point in the not-so-far-back future, Raquel Pennington was just considered a wayward former title challenger, the dust in the wind, the whatever you want to throw out there. The writing was kind of on the wall for Raquel Pennington. Whether you went with the UFC's record, where they had her as 10-9 because they consider one of those 3-round fights that's an exhibition on The Ultimate Fighter as a real fight, which is kind of dumb, but they do it. We're not doing it this weekend. She was 10-8 at one point. And now she's on a 3-fight win streak, and it's a tidy little win streak at that, with wins over some names that you might recognize in the rankings, Marion Renault, Penny Kianzad, and then finishing Macy Chasson her last time out. Raquel Pennington, giant career resurgence, 13-8, and she's only 33 years old in this division. Now, that last fight against Chasson, somewhat short notice. It was up at 145. Aspen Ladd was supposed to take on Macy Chasson at one point, but that fight never happened because Aspen Ladd weighed in at 137. So for Ladd, she's had some issues. She's come out on the other side. She fights at 145 against Norma Dumont and had historically low output until the 4th round. But how historically low was it, Craig? Well, I have the numbers. She went 3 of 17 for strikes in the 1st round.
Is she Damian Maia fighting Tyron Woodley?
That was a 17% clip. In the 2nd round, she went 4 of 21. That's a 19% clip. In the third round, she went 9 of 34. That's a 26% clip. In the fourth round, she went 12 of 29. And then in the fifth round, she went 5 of 9. Aspen Ladd had the worst performance of her career in her last time out. And listen, yeah, the fight against Jermaine Durandamy was bad. And yeah, that fight was close to home. But that fight against Norma Dumont in a five-round main event, it was a head-scratcher of a fight even before the two fighters walked into the octagon. It's still a weird fight now. And for Aspen Ladd, so many question marks coming out of that one.
I agree with everything you said. But I still think getting knocked out in 20 seconds by Jermaine Durandamy is a little bit worse. Now, for Ladd, it is unfortunate because there's a few fighters that fall into this cycle where it's you get a big opportunity and you just come up short every time. And for Ladd, she has had two main event slots in the UFC, and that's a lot for a fighter, for any fighter. I know people get on like Anthony Smith for being in a lot of Fight Night main events, but that's because he's kind of earned it at this stage of his career. For Aspen Ladd to only be 9-2 in her career and already have two main event slots, it just kind of tells you where the UFC has her in their overall hierarchy of 135. For Raquel Pennington, I think you'll appreciate this one, Craig. You know who her NBA comp is. Someone who had a lot of hype, they sort of faltered a little bit, and now with a reduced role, they're shining. JaVale McGee!
Any six man.
Raquel Pennington, though, to me is like JaVale McGee. Every time you write them off, they're gonna kind of show you something you never really thought that they had in them, but you do have to have realistic expectations of where Pennington is at this stage of her career. She's not someone who is going to go on a run and get back to a title shot. At least I don't believe that she will. But she's a phenomenal gatekeeper to that top 7-6 range. She's not somebody who you beat and you immediately get a title shot off of. But when you do beat Raquel Pennington, it proves to everybody that, hey, you are more than just a striker. You're more than just a wrestler. Because to beat Pennington, you do have to be well-rounded. She's at least a little good everywhere. And that's the great thing about Pennington. No matter who she's matched up against, there's always something that you can point to and think, hey, Pennington has at least this type of an advantage over her opponent. And even for this one, like Aspen Ladd, you bring it up. Is she a good striker? Not at all. She's a phenomenal grappler, though. But even against someone like Raquel Pennington, who herself is a good grappler, I don't think Aspen Ladd is going to go out there and completely wash her if this gets to the mat. I think this could be a very competitive fight, no matter what stage it ends up in.
So Matt, you said something that plays into what I have to say for this one, and the fact that Raquel Pennington, great, maybe a gatekeeper for the top 5, top 7. She's ranked 7 in this one. This fight was announced on March 26th, because Raquel Pennington is a short-notice replacement for your third-ranked Irene Aldana. Aspen Ladd's ranked 4th. Like, it is a weird fight. It is at the top of the division. So Ladd now going down, but she's also an underdog now. And I don't normally talk about the odds right now in a video. There's kind of a formula that we follow, if you've ever noticed that. But Ladd opened as a plus 125. She's a plus 163 on best fight odds. For Raquel Pennington, open to minus 145. She's a minus 200. So coming in on short notice, ranked lower, Raquel Pennington is the favorite. This is the part that I don't understand. Aspen Ladd, again, you talk about buying a fighter high and selling low. Aspen Ladd in Invicta with the one fight against Tajara Eubanks and then through the UFC. Minus 270 against Eubanks the first time. Minus 250 against Lena Landsberg. Minus 185 against Tonya Evinger. Minus 260 against Tajara Eubanks the second time. Minus 135 against Jermaine Durandamy. She loses. Minus 175 against Yana Kuninskaya. Minus 135 against Norma Dumont. Aspen Ladd's never been an underdog, ever. Like, she's never been an underdog. She's now an underdog against a fighter coming in on short notice, ranked lower than her, on a win streak, and it's tiny and impressive as Raquel Pennington might be on that win streak. It's just one of those ones where I had the logic of the Kay Hansen fight, where she's been a giant favorite in her last three fights, 1-2 in those fights. She has some tools that I think will play out against Piera Rodriguez. But in this fight, Aspen Ladd's tools and Raquel Pennington's tools, they're kind of the same. They're different in different ways, and I know you're going to get to that. But when it comes to grappling, Raquel Pennington, she's one of those fighters. We're talking head and chest. Like, she's always pushing it up against the cage, really implementing a physical game plan. It's just odd to see Ladd as such a big favorite in all of these fights. Favorite against Dumont, loses and doesn't look good. And now we're just whoop. Like, big enough underdog.
I think it's way too much of an overcorrection, if we're being honest, because Aspen Ladd's a fighter who used to fight at flyweight, and I understand she's had some weight issues throughout her career, but still, you're dealing with someone who fought at flyweight, being expected to perform at the same level at featherweight. It's just probably not going to happen, and Norma Dumont, at least up until that point, hadn't showed us that much in the UFC, if we're all being honest, but she looked really good in that fight against Aspen Ladd, to her credit. So I really do think it's an overcorrection, because if you go back just one fight before that, what Aspen Ladd did to Yana Kunitskaya should be illegal in the UFC cage. That was one of the most one-sided finishes the second that fight hit the mat, because Ladd has a game very similar to someone like Gregor Gillespie, to where when it's on the feet, yeah, you worry about them. They're a little bit basic, even though I don't think Aspen Ladd as a garbage striker by any means. I really do think it's a confidence thing with her. Like, Paul Craig talked about this with an interview with Ariel Helwani right after he fought Nikita Krylov. He was like, listen, I know in a lot of my fights I get beat up and then I get this Hail Mary. But, like, if you just see me in the gym, if you see me strike, I'm genuinely a good striker. I'm just so, like, anxious about that part of my game when I'm at the UFC level that you guys never really get to see that. I think with Ladd, if she was just a little bit more comfortable with her own boxing, she would have some success on the inside because that's where her game is centered around anyway. So this is something we talk about a lot when we talk about championship level fighters, but the synergy that their games have and how Volkanovski, someone we'll be talking about later, he can wrestle on the inside, throw body shots, everything he does works together. Aspen Ladd has a lot of very good singular skills. It's just a matter of, can she put it all together? Whereas Pennington, I don't think she does any one thing to the level that Aspen Ladd can grapple, but since she is so well-rounded and just sort of, and I don't mean this negatively at all, she has kind of a watered-down skill set to where it covers a lot more areas than Aspen Ladd does. I think Pennington does have a really good chance to win this fight, even though I know I've been kind of setting that up as a pro-Aspen Ladd prediction, but this is as close of a fight as you can get in this division, and it's interesting because in some divisions, there's a big separation between the top three and everybody else. Like, again, last NBA reference for at least this video. Like, for the MVP right now, there's top three, Giannis, Joel, and Jokic, and then there's everybody else. In some fighting divisions, we have that too. Women's bantamweight right now, one or two good wins can get you up fighting Jessica Penne. You might even be able to fight like Amanda Nunes if they don't want to immediately do that rematch. So I know I said Raquel Pennington isn't going to get to a title shot, but the more I'm thinking about it...
Jessica Penne.
Sorry, the more I'm talking about it...
Juliana Pena.
Thank you. Could Raquel Pennington be fighting for a title if she beats Aspen Ladd? Looks impressive. Like, is that what this fight is?
I mean, she beat Miesha Tate Waiter a few years, and then we got a title shot.
You're right.
It is a weird one. We talked about the odds. Ladd the underdog, Pennington the favorite. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there to you. Honestly, they've been all over the board, and we don't put much stock in it, but it is a lot of fun to talk about them, so I'm not even going to guess on this one.
Okay.
66% Pennington out of 1,561 total votes, 88% by decision for the 34% that I've Ladd, 81% by decision for Ladd. Her main event was 5 months ago against Norma Dumont. It was an awful fight. For Pennington coming in on short notice, it was about, 3 months ago when she took on Macy Chasson and brutalized her and was able to get that submission. Like, she could take a down in that fight and was able to get a submission win.
And Macy's good.
A lot of fun. Macy's great on the feet. With the grappling, yeah.
Well, no, but beating her means you're a good fighter.
Matt, when it comes down to this pick, though, again, like, when you have somebody that's a favorite all the way, and now you're that big of an underdog, is that just a great opportunity on Aspen Ladd here?
Not really. I don't really look at the odds that much going into that. Like, that's just how people react to her performances after the fact. That's all the odds.
But even, like, she was a minus 135 against Duranemi, gets knocked out quick, and then when she fights Kuniskaya, she's minus 175.
But Kuniskaya wasn't on a big run at that point either. That's true. So, it just, for Ladd, if you've watched her fights, you kind of know what you're going to get. If she can get on top of her opponent, she's incredibly dominant. Like, she truly is. But if she can't do that, there's not a lot of other aspects to her game where you can look at and think, wow, she can consistently win rounds via her boxing, via her clinch control. Just different areas. I really look at her as a one-trick pony, but that one trick is pretty effing good if she is able to get it down to the mat. For those reasons, I'm going to pick Aspen Ladd. I do think if she is able to get that one takedown, especially early on in the fight, it's going to knock Pennington's cardio down to whatever level Aspen Ladd's is on, and it is going to get rid of some of the tools of Raquel Pennington. Yes, she's a good offensive grappler. She's not a great defensive grappler. Amanda Nunes took her down like 15 times in their fight, and Amanda's not a great wrestler. Like, that is probably the weakest part of her game. The other part about Pennington, too, that I don't love, she's had a lot of leg injuries in the past, and I do think it has hurt her ability to eat leg kicks. I know that's not something we talk about a lot, but going into the Amanda Nunes fight, she broke her leg, that's why she took so much time off, but ever since, she just doesn't react all that well when she does get hit to that leg. Just something to watch out for. Again, just because I say it doesn't mean it's true and it's going to be a big problem, but it's always something I've looked out for ever since that injury has occurred. So I'm going to pick Aspen Ladd, but like you said, on short notice, a fighter that a lot of people have kind of written off of this division, it's nice to see Raquel Pennington get her footing back and kind of become the fighter that she once was.
This is a fight for question mark kicks if there ever were one on Saturday, because Ladd, again, it's not just been one instance of the weight issues, and for Raquel Pennington, she had that anomaly at 145 her last time out. It was on short notice. This one, it's billed as bantamweight. We'll see how it plays out. For Pennington, kind of walks people down like Sean Strickland. Like, that's kind of the way that she just kind of marches good forward, call. Gets into the clinch if she takes it down or brutalizes you up against the fence. That's how she does it. Great opportunity for Pennington. I also have Ladd. Again, I like the underdog spot on her and the fact that takes it down. It's very formulaic. We're going to get into position. We're really going to hammer down some blows. I like Aspinlad in this opportunity. Younger fighter, fresher fighter, and it was a fight that she was going to be taking against Irene Aldana, who definitely has very good boxing. So an interesting switch of opponent here, but both of us going with California's Aspinlad in this opportunity. You talk about it for the cardio. Raquel Pennington, she's been at altitude for a very long time. She does usually have that in her back pocket. So great opportunity for both of these fighters. We're deviating from the Tapology votes and from the odds, and we're going with Ladd. Who do you have in this fight and the rest of the fights on this big-time card? Two title fights up at the top you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Like hockey in the early 2000s, this fight is pitting run-and-gun offense against the trap, and we're going to see which one wins out. We have Tibor. Marcin Tybura out of Ancos MMA taking on Biggie Boy out of Suriname. We have Jairzinho Rozenstruik. And for Rozenstruik, it was one of those rises where in 2021, he was the leading man. He was going into the Oscars celebration like, hey, this guy might win as long as he doesn't slap the host. And he didn't. But for Rozenstruik, they were big time wins that he was able to just rack up. And they just continued every single weekend, it seemed. I mean, whether it was Junior Albini, where it really kicked off, Alan Crowder, Andre Arlovsky, all first round, except for the Albini fight that was in the second round. And then he goes out there against Alistair Overeem and gets his ass handed to him for 4.5 rounds, if not more. And then with 4 seconds left on the clock, he throws it up and it lands and he knocks out Alistair Overeem. So really, Rozenstruik was the leading man in 2019. 2020 was Kevin Holland and so on and so forth. But if you look at it, he then goes out there and fights windmill punches Francis Ngannou and he gets knocked out quickly. He beats Junior Dos Santos. That's a good win. I know it was late in Junior's, you know, UFC run, but still. He goes out there against Ciryl Gane, and he was a little bit shy to use his weapons, and Gane did a great job of crashing the distance, not giving him the separation, and able to get the win there. But if you look at that one, it was a 5-round main event. He goes out, he takes on Augusto Sakai, another main event, knocks him out at the end of the first round. Then he fights Curtis Blaydes on the main card of UFC 266, Volkanovski versus Ortega, and he loses that fight. He gets taken down 3 times, and for Rozenstruik, you might think, listen, the guy is a pure kickboxer, we know this, and he has no takedown defense. That's not entirely true. He has decent takedown defense, but against those upper echelon guys, he's getting taken down. We're going to find out this weekend if Marcin Tybura is an upper echelon guy with the takedowns, because for Tybura, his last time out against Alexander Volkov, he looked like if you left a can of 7-Up on the counter open for a week, that's what he looked like. Very, very flat.
Neither guy looked good in that fight, though, if we're telling the complete story. Like, no. Volkov looked awful, too. It's just Tybura never really got out of first gear. That was the surprising thing, because for Marcin Tybura, and I know against Volkov, this is a tough game plan to follow, but what does Marcin Tybura normally do? Gets his ass beat for 5 minutes, comes in the second round, gets on top of his opponent, and then beats them. Like, there normally has to be a point in his fights where he weathers a storm. And against someone like Jairzinho Rozenstruik, that's a tough kind of game plan to go out there with, because Rozenstruik's really unique. Like, have you watched the TV show Jessica Jones?
Yeah.
It's good. Okay, Jairzinho to me is kind of like Jessica Jones. He has all these powers, but he has no idea how to use them. He never does what you want him to do, because Jairzinho, the second he takes a step forward, he's like Thanos. Nobody can withstand what he has. He has head kicks for a heavyweight. He's this level of athlete that you do not expect for him being 6'2" and weighing close to 260 pounds. Like, he's got that, and I can't believe I'm about to forget his name, Javi Ayala, thank you. He's got that Javi Ayala-ness to his game where you're like, wow, he could throw jumping head kicks off
this
his left leg.
This guy's athletic, but he's like 250, 260?
You don't expect it whatsoever. But that's the really frustrating thing about Rozenstruik. We only see those glimpses in his fights for about 30 seconds, and then he either wins by knockout, or he'll just kind of stay in first gear himself, and we never really see the progression of his game. And the Augusto Sakai fight is kind of the perfect example, because Sakai, listen, he not the guy we thought he was, but still, their fight, neither guy's doing anything. They're both kind of looking in a mirror. And then with like 30 seconds left in the first round, Rozenstruik decides, okay, I can move forward and throw strikes. And what happens the second he does that? Knocks Sakai out, and it's like a beautiful knockout too. So for Rozenstruik, it's just really frustrating because you know that when he is dedicated to his striking, when he's willing to get into a bit of an ugly fight to then, you know, let his own striking kind of show off, then he is a really good fighter. It's just almost the mental block of, okay, I have to let my hands go. I have to let my kicks go. Because if he does just stand in a mirror against someone like Marcin Tybura, that's when Tybura will be able to sort of slowly walk his way into range, get into the clinch, go for the takedown, and use his great grappling, be it with his submissions or with his ground and pound. Because for as big of an advantage that I think Rozenstruik has in the feet in this fight, I think Tybura has a much bigger advantage if this fight does hit the mat.
To me, like, was it a surprise that Blaydes couldn't finish Rozenstruik on the ground? You know, when you compare Blaydes to Marcin Tybura?
I'm only going to say no, because here's the thing. Curtis Blaydes has only really been a finisher in two fights in the UFC. Against Rozenstruik, that was just a weird fight, because like you said, it does kind of show off how good Rozenstruik's takedown defense is, because he's able to defend a few of those attempts from the much bigger Curtis Blaydes. But for Rozenstruik, that was just a weird fight, because there was a lot of like, hey, you're really strong but can't get the takedown, and I'm really strong but I'm good at digging double underhooks. So that was just an odd fight, but it was a frustrating fight because it showed Rozenstruik's inability to create separation after the takedown attack.
So you look at this one, Marcin Tybura, and I'll throw it up there from Instagram. He's training with, like, strongmen and actual guys at Ancos. But look at the guy that's next to him in the picture there. Like, the guy is massive. And then if you look at it for Rozenstruik, back at American Top Team, he has his original coach with him, Michael Babb. So I want to make mention of that. He's got Marcelo Gomes there to train with and King Mo in one of the pictures that's there. And if you look at it, I mean, you know, for Rozenstruik, he's had a couple of those fights where it's like, you know what? I've got that Aaron Rodgers in me in 2015. I can throw that Hail Mary and I can really land it. And then he has points where we're just fighting in a mirror and we're not really doing a whole heck of a lot.
It's so strange.
So it is. You look at the odds for this one. Rozenstruik is the favorite. Open a minus 130. He's roughly a minus 135 or thereabouts. For Tybura, open plus 110. He's at a plus 130 or thereabouts. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 67.5% Rozenstruik.
I think Tybura will be the favorite.
No.
No.
1,747 total votes, 72% Rozenstruik, 85% by knockout. For the 28% that have Tybura, 60% by decision, you get 23% by knockout, the rest and change by submission. So Matt, with the pick for this one, again, we've seen Tybura, let's pick off that win streak that he had. Max Gretian, Ben Rothwell, no longer with the UFC. The win over Greg Hardy, the win over Walt Harris, and then the loss to Volkov where it was just flat pop on the counter. And for Rozenstruik, he did have a 4-0 start, and since then, 2-3, the loss to Ngannou, win over JDS, lost to Gan, win over Sakai, and then the loss to Curtis Blaydes. Who do you have in this fight?
Jairzinho did hit Curtis Blaydes with a flying knee that would knock out, like, most horses. Like,
and probably Marcin Tybura.
And probably Marcin Tybura. Very good point. That's the thing about Rozenstruik. Again, every time you think he's going to be what he is, he's not going to meet your expectations whatsoever.
Would you anchor a parlay to this?
I'm going to make a little bit of fun of you. You did put Nikita Krylov in a question mark kicks parlay not that long ago, and I would put Jairzinho in that category of you never know what the heck you're going to get, so I would just never put money on these types of fighters, because for Rozenstruik, the best version of him could honestly knock out Stipe Miocic in like 30 seconds. The worst version of him could get knocked out by Stipe Miocic in like 30 seconds. This is one of those all-or-nothing fights for both guys. I think Rozenstruik does have good enough takedown defense, though, to at least stop the initial takedown attempts from Tybura. And for Marcin, he doesn't have bad striking by any means. I actually do think he's an underrated striker, but he's not someone who can eat power shots from Rozenstruik on the feet round after round. And that's the one thing about Tybura. He's not a bad offensive striker, but he does struggle defensively with his striking defense. Even Greg Hardy was able to lump him up early in their fight. And I think if Greg Hardy can hit you clean, Jairzinho could probably knock you out.
Marcin Tybura, a corgi guy, and for Jairzinho, Rozenstruik on Direk, c'est un meli melo de performance. You have no idea what the heck you're going to get. It's like, I don't know, it's like a gobstopper. It's purple. But what's the flavor once I get to the second tier? I don't know. So for me, I agree. I do have Surnam's Rozenstruik in this fight, which might seem counterintuitive the way that I've ever picked any fight, because normally at heavyweight, I go with a guy that has a grappling advantage. But for Tybura, he is one of those guys. So Rozenstruik struggles when you get on the inside. It really is. Now I'm in defensive mode. He doesn't really have the offensive tools when he's in the clinch, up against the cage, so on and so forth. Doesn't really throw a lot of elbows to create the separation. For Tybura, he strikes the clinch the takedown, and then from there, you're in Marcin's world. But I don't see him having the success with that against a guy like Rozenstruik. So against what I normally say in a lot of these fights, I am taking Rozenstruik.
And I do think cardio is oddly important in this fight. I feel like a lot of people, when they look at this fight on paper, they immediately go, well, Marcin Tybura has the better cardio out of these guys. I don't know about that. Like, Jairzinho Rozenstruik genuinely has good power late into a fifth round fight. That means a lot cardio-wise for a fighter. You can't just always look at the way that they fight and think, wow, this power puncher is going to get tired faster than the other guy who's the wrestler. Because for Rozenstrike, that's the great thing about the sport of MMA, and that's why stats don't really matter. If you look at the stats against Alistair Overeem and you don't look at the result, you're like, oh my god, he lost a 50-40 decision. Then you look at the result, you're like, oh no, with 4 seconds left, he flatlined him. So that's the great thing about this sport. And I do think Rozenstrike, even if this fight does go late, he can still have success, and that's why I like him in it.
Both of us going with Suriname and American Top Team's own Jairzinho Rozenstrike in this fight to get the win. Let us know if we are completely off. I mean, I picked Marcin Tybura in like every fight since 2010 to get a win, so big time opportunity for both of these guys. Keep locked into that comment section. Always loving hearing your reactions to these fights. Toss a like if you haven't already, and a subscription really means a lot to us. You could hit that one. It would mean a lot. Big time card coming up this weekend. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Ireland's next big star makes a second appearance with the UFC, following up a big-time first-round knockout win over Jordan Williams. We're talking about the former Cage Warriors welterweight champ, the future Ian Garry, the recently married Ian Garry.
Congrats.
Going over to Vegas, getting married to Layla Anna Lee, and now we're here. Training out of Sanford MMA is Garry. He's had the last couple of camps over there, and in his UFC debut, bit of a mixed bag. I mean, he did knock out Jordan Williams in the first round. He received a lot of punishment in that first round. We'll talk about that one quite a bit. But he's taking on Darian Weeks out of Hewlett House, Missouri's own. And when you look at it for Darian Weeks, very well-rounded skill set. Maybe takedown defense isn't the strongest bit of his game, but offensive takedowns and offensive wrestling coupled with very, very good boxing and a tidy little leg kick bring everything together for Darian Weeks. And he got a short notice opportunity back in December to make his UFC debut against Brian Barberina. Was able to get the second round somewhat convincingly, I would say. First round was pretty damn close, and in the third round, Brian Barberina really kicked it into high gear. But for Darian Weeks, you got to consider this too. He went from fighting not the highest level of competition on the regional scene, and I think, like, you can't talk about that enough. His fight to come into the UFC was against 3-4 Craig Fairley, and I don't know what Craig Fairley and Dustin Parrish before him on Mr. Weeks' record had, like, just this affinity for leg locks, but they kept trying leg locks. And you can't get Darian Weeks out of there by leg lock. So I don't know if like John Donaher was on speed dial for the camps of those guys, but Weeks able to get out of some of those compromising positions. And even in the fight against Parrish, where he gets taken down, he gets dominated, he ends up reversing position as that fight went on and really poured on the pressure. So for Darian Weeks, very interesting prospect. Obviously for Ian Garry, a lot of hype. He's able to get that win in Cage Warriors to book his ticket against Jack Grant to win the belt, decision win there. To end up into the UFC, Jack Grant, lightweight, but still, Ian Garry, uber prospect, and a lot of people are hot and heavy on Garry.
Garry's so hot right now. For Darian Weeks, it is unfortunate because, like you said, he's one of these guys who looked really impressive against guys who, let's be honest, he probably should have beat on the regional scene, and then he was getting thrown in against Brian Barberina, someone who, yes, there's question marks, but mainly just surrounding, like, medically Barberina.
Tuesday of fight week, he gets that call.
Exactly, and he did make a fairly good account of himself. I didn't think he won the fight, but he made it competitive against a good fighter in Brian Barberina. Maybe not someone who we think is a top-tier fighter at 170, but still, if you have a competitive fight with someone like Barberina, there is a spot for you in the UFC, and that's something we can all agree on. The big issue with Weeks, though, and you kind of alluded to this at the start of the video, is that Weeks' big Achilles heel in his whole game is his wrestling defense. And I know people are pretty fired up about Ian Garry because he got a knockout his last time out, but Ian Garry is a phenomenal grappler, and he's somebody who, when he does get on top, makes you pay for every second you are on the ground under him. I see a lot of the, I guess, narrative this week just being about how Garry, have you seen his hands and how good his boxing is? I don't expect Ian Garry to beat a lot of like top fighters just with his boxing at the UFC. I really do think he is going to have to implement his grappling a lot more when he does start to fight the upper echelon guys, but that's a great thing to do. Like, he's a phenomenal grappler. He has good submission wins, great ground and pound though, and that really is Ian Garry. It might not be his specialty, but that's the one area of his game that I do like the most because it just wears on his opponent. It's an offensive tool that also drains your opponent and makes them a lesser version of themselves later on. So for Garry, I like him on the feet early on in the fight with the straight shots in his boxing. It will be interesting, though, if Weeks goes to the body of Ian Garry, because Ian Garry's as big of a welterweight as you can possibly be. And we were talking about this before we started filming. Him and Luke Rockhold are the only two guys in the UFC I can think of who it's like their only goal is to stand up as straight as possible. Jordan Wright, I guess we can throw him in that category, too. It's just not really... those aren't guys you want to be in a category with. And for Ian Garry, it does worry me. It's like... when you have non-shooters on the court in basketball, it affects everything else to a certain degree because you don't have to worry about that guy as far away anymore. So we can all sort of focus on the people who do matter and who can shoot. For Ian Garry, when you stand up really straight, it might not immediately be an issue, but it's going to start to show holes later on when you start to fight upper echelon guys. Like, if Ian Garry fought, let's say even like a Santiago Ponzinibbio. I know he's a good fighter, but he's a little bit older now. He's not ranked anymore. Santiago could kick his leg apart, go to the body with his hooks, and really make him pay for some of those defensive lapses that he does have, but I'm really excited to see what version of Ian Garry we get in this fight, and if we do see the overall wrestling package of his game, because I feel like people will really start to believe in Ian Garry as a UFC prospect, and I know he has hype right now, but I genuinely do think there's another level that they could take it to if he does go out there and have maybe like a Jack Shore, Timur Valiyev type fight, you know, where he's tested, he has to really dig deep and come on strong later on. I think that's the type of performance that would really get people on an Ian Garry hype train.
I see this fight being a grind. I don't love the odds, and I wouldn't anchor a damn thing to Ian Garry. And I bought into the hype coming in fighting Jordan Williams, because Williams, what does he do? Well, he strikes, but he struggles with striking defense. And when you can really rock him, like, he gets wobbled and hurt fairly easily. And Williams just goes out there, crowds that distance, chases him around the cage, and doesn't necessarily even cut it, but Gary's just on the back foot, deer in the headlights, standing straight up, eating a lot of punishment. And Williams was able to mix it up well to the body and to the head, so it's one of those things that I do worry about Ian Garry now, even against a guy like, you might not have even heard of Darian Weeks. You're just a fan of Ian Garry and you found us. I'm not as sold on Ian Garry. Now again, Garry started boxing at the age of 10. He's a judo black belt. We see these things implemented in his game plan. So again, he does have a great basis. He has moved his camp over to Sanford MMA, training with Jason Jackson. Again, you see Mickey Gall over there. We already touched on it. Yaroslav Amosov fighting for his country, pulling belts out of burning buildings. Like, that's kind of crazy. But Amosov, another guy that while he was at Sanford, you would have gotten an opportunity to train with him as well. So
think how much better that would make you too, training with a guy like Amosov. Like, he's good on the feet. He never gets tired, and he's a great wrestler. Kind of the perfect guy to train with every day.
Wild stuff. So, Matt, we look at this fight, and for Ian Garry, he, again, a giant favorite. Open to minus 185, he's a minus 360. For Darian Weeks, open to plus 155, he's a plus 280. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, and they're a surprise to us, they're to you, Matt, I'm going to say 90% Ian Garry, over-under.
I'll say over.
You're going to say over? Ooh, just over. Look at that. 1,758 total votes, 92% Garry, 75% by knockout for the 8% that have Weeks, 52% by knockout. Matt, I think this fight is going to go to a decision, so I disagree with all of the voters out there. I think Ian Garry will get the win, but man, I would not be surprised. Darian Weeks has some really, really crisp boxing, great 1-2, great right hand, good ability with his leg kicks as well. I think this is a really tough test for Ian Garry.
I do too. I think he's going to be able to win this fight. Now, I could see him winning by finish. I'm not going to say finish or decision. I do think he's going to be able to win, but I do think Darian Weeks is being overlooked. I don't think you can take a lot out of his last performance against Brian Barberena because he has so much stacked against him in that fight that it was borderline ridiculous, if we're being honest. But I do like Weeks' ability to switch it up on the feet, and I do think body shots are going to be a really interesting thing just going along in the career of Ian Garry. He's huge for the weight class, shows a lot of his body, and he's not someone who's like really built up a lot in their midsection, so I'm really curious to see if body shots do affect him. But like, okay, Errol Spence Jr. is fighting Ugas in a week, and that's the big conversation of that fight. Like, can Errol Spence eat the body shots of Ugas? He's built in a very similar way to a guy like Ian Garry, so it's just coming to mind. That's why I'm bringing it up right now. I'm curious to see if Garry will be able to strike with the upper echelon guys. Like, Alicio Zaleski dos Santos would be a really fun opponent for him if he's able to beat Darian Weeks. That'd be a good opponent next. So I think Gary's going to be able to get the win, but this is a tough fight.
Elizeu, we want you, but it'll probably be Benoit Saint-Denis if we're being honest. Big time opportunity for both of these guys, Matt, both of us going with Ireland's Ian Garry, but not with the confidence of the almost 4-1 favorite that he is right now. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have, because I threw this one out there on Twitter, and there were a lot of people that were talking about Darian Weeks in this opportunity. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Clash of Styles is at 115 pounds, and it means a lot to this division. We have Mackenzie Dern taking on the tiny Tornado Tisha Torres. And Matt, well, I said Tornado like somebody that's from, I don't know, somewhere in the States, picked the place. If I look at Tisha Torres, she went on a four-fight losing streak a while ago, and I'm going to list off the names in that losing streak. Jessica Andrade, former champ. Joanna Jędrzejczyk, former champ. Weili Zhang, former champ. Marina Rodriguez, future champ. Pretty crazy how that stuff happened. So that spanned from, well, early 2018 to the end of 2019. Since then, 2020, a win over the recently renamed Brianna Fortino, formerly Van Buren. Then she gets a win over Sam Hughes, finishes her. That was on short notice, replacing Angela Hill. Then she gets the Angela Hill fight, and she looked very good in that one. That fight was back in August of last year. So for Tisha Torres, a little bit of time away. For Mackenzie Dern, her last time out, it was a main event against Marina Rodriguez, the aforementioned Rodriguez, future champ. That fight was 5 months ago in a fight where Mackenzie Dern had her Brian Ortega moment in that fight, like Ortega did against Volkanovski. Mackenzie Dern was in her spot against Marina Rodriguez. Rodriguez just held on, and then she withstood it. And then she was able to really pour on her pressure with her striking, with her volume striking, which is something that you also see at Tisha Torres, who implements more wrestling than we see out of Rodriguez. But still, this is a very, very tough fight to really talk about. It is.
It is. And for Torres, she is in... It's a weird purgatory right now in the division, if we're all being honest, because you point to her four losses. All of those are forgivable. Those are four of the best fighters in the division's history. You look at her three recent wins, though, none of them mean that much, if we're all being honest. The Angela Hill win's a good win, but Angela Hill hasn't really looked like herself in a meaningful period of time at this point. So for me, there's still a bit of a range to where, like, I don't really know what version of Tisha Torres we're going to get, because we always know what her skill set is. She is a wrestle boxer to the highest degree. She doesn't throw kicks at all. She'll throw a left kick to the body every now and then to close the distance, but it's definitely part of her game to where you're thinking, wow, Torres is going to be kick heavy. So she has to get on the inside and use her boxing. And 9 times out of 10, she has to take down her opponent to win a fight. It is very, very difficult for Tisha Torres to just go out there. And I really do think this has to do more with just her physicality and her size of the division, because it's really hard for her to stay on the outside and really pitter-patter away, because she has such short arms and she's very small for this division. So she is someone who, A, needs to get on top of her opponent, and B, needs to go to the body and to the head with her boxing combinations when she does get on the inside. That's a very, very risky game plan when you're fighting someone like Mackenzie Dern, who, yes, she struggled at range a lot with Marina Rodriguez in that fight, but that's the big difference between Tisha Torres and a striker like Rodriguez, who can hit you from basically across the cage. She's so long in this division, whereas Torres is really going to have to close the distance much more to really be effective with her strikes. And for Dern, like you said, honestly, that fight, I don't look at it as a huge negative for Mackenzie Dern. I just think Marina Rodriguez is that good of a fighter to where she can stay patient in bad positions, similar to like Montel Jackson. I give him a lot of credit for that. Montel Jackson is one of the few guys who can go from being in a rear naked choke to having like a Kevin Holland expression on his face where he's like, okay, I'm not tapping out, to immediately dropping and hurting his opponent right after. I really liked what I saw out of Rodriguez in that performance, because it just showed a certain level of professionalism that we had yet to see up until that point. So for Dern, yes, she really struggled at least getting the takedown after that point, but that's the weird thing about Dern. Is she better grappling than Tisha Torres? Without a doubt. They're, again, not even in the same planets, but she lacks the wrestling to get this fight to where she wants it. So for Dern, I think she's going to have success on the feet in this fight, but that's going to be a hard ask against Torres, who's so fast with the combos.
The thing that it's weird, because I just disagree on one point. When Tisha Torres took on Brianna Van Buren, it was Van Buren initiating the takedowns, and it was Torres having success on the feet, but Van Buren, not much of a striker, it is primarily wrestling, whereas Torres can mix it up enough to where she is a much more polished striker when she takes on just a wrestler, but when she takes on a good striker, she then can wrestle, and you saw that out of her performance after that. And then in the Angela Hill fight, Hill was able to get a couple takedowns, Torres was able to get one, and it all came out in the wash. At the end of it, Torres able to get the win. Mackenzie Dern, numerically, very poor takedown defense, but you know exactly why. It's not like Damian Maia had the best takedown defense either. We're out there to try and submit you, and if you try and take me down, I will then try and submit you. We saw that out of even Mike Malott in his last fight on Dana White's Contender Series, who's also on this card. You should go check out that video. He's taking on Mickey Gall. But again, we look at this one for Torres. Her losses are to the upper echelon. And then you can also say, okay, well, she lost to Rose Namajunas a while back. Well, future champ or former champ. She also lost to Carla Esparza in The Ultimate Fighter, who then went on to win that season and become the champion. So Tisha Torres really has only lost to the upper echelon of competition. During the two losses in the UFC, one to Amanda Ribas, where it did not go well. And then the fight, which was a fight of the night against Marina Rodriguez. Performance bonuses against Hannah Cyphers, Randa Marcos, and Nina Nunes. And in that Nina Nunes fight, I said I would mention it. Mackenzie Dern looked like a reinvented fighter. It was like, this is striking Mackenzie Dern now? Oh my goodness. She looked great against a good striker, Nunes, who had the long layoff, was coming off the pregnancy, and so on and so forth. So some extenuating circumstances there. But nonetheless, we have a look at the odds for this one. They opened at par. Dern, slight favorite, minus 120. Torres, slight underdog. We'll call it a minus 105. Let's have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over-under, heavily skewed to Dern, but I'll say 67.5% Dern over-under.
I think it'll be over.
You think it's going to be over? It is over. 1,790 total votes, 70% Dern, 62% by decision for the 30% that have Torres, 88% by decision, Matt. It would seem so that would be the way that Teach Torres would win a fight against Mackenzie Dern. What do you say?
So Mackenzie Dern is one of these classic fighters who really has to rely on her opponent to make a mistake, and then she has the ultimate ability to capitalize, because when you're as good as Mackenzie Dern is at jiu-jitsu, it's basically like having Francis Ngannou knockout power. It's just, you have to use it in a very different way. You have the ability to end the fight just like that. And that's a really, really powerful thing to have when you're in an MMA cage, especially at the strawweight division. But this is the problem. Teisha Torres doesn't make a lot of mistakes. She basically makes none. And that's the thing about Torres. When she loses fights, it's because she's so overmatched on the feet 9 times out of 10 that she can't fire anything back on her opponent. Go back to the Wei Li fight, go back to the Ioana fight. It's really just her on the receiving end of a lot of combinations. And then physically, because she is a lot smaller than those women, she doesn't have any tools to then get on the inside. And Wei Li and Ioana, don't know if you guys know this, have phenomenal takedown defense. So when she was able to get on the inside, she wasn't able to have a lot of success there. Those are all very fundamental skills, though, and that really those are what Teisha Torres excel at. She's kind of like Tim Duncan, the big fundamental. And for those reasons, I do think Torres is going to be able to beat Mackenzie Dern. I don't think it's going to be pretty by any means, but I think she's the steadier fighter on the feet. And her output numbers are absurd at this division. I know, you know, numbers, like we just brought it up, you can't put a lot into them, but Torres truly does have phenomenal cardio, and she's someone who constantly throws punches when she is on the feet. So unless Dern's able to hit her with a big shot and get her down that way, or immediately get like a wonky takedown from a heel hook attempt or something and end up on top from that, I do like Teisha Torres in this matchup.
Mackenzie Dern went 0-5 on takedown attempts against Vina Janjidova. She was able to outstrike her. I thought Vina won the fight, but regardless of how that fight went, Matt, it's the fact that they went strike for strike and Dern wasn't able to get the takedown against a good grappler. Vina was able to get her own takedown and the fight went as the fight went. And for some reason, Vina Janjidova is a picture on Ariel Helwani's set on the MMA Hour.
Because if she came out to Island Boys, the song, he said he would permanently put the person's face behind him. Sean Brady was originally going to do it, but Vina fought before he did, so she took it.
Do you think we can have a poll like that? All right, if Teisha Torres walks out to the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald... I'll put Teisha Torres' picture, and then I have the record, so we'll put Gordon Lightfoot on the wall, too.
I think we can make it a lot better, but okay.
I mean, Wreck the Edmund Fitzgerald, it's a great song. But when it comes to this fight, I'm in agreement here. I have Teisha Torres. I love the volume on the feet. Her strikes landed per minute number is higher than an already high number of strikes absorbed per minute that Mackenzie Dern actually has on her stat line. Again, stats and records for DJs, but Gordon Lightfoot, you never know. It could happen.
Records are for DJs. Stats are.
For both of us, we're going with Teisha Torres in this fight as a slight underdog. You let us know who you have down below in the comment section. The fans and the odds both in agreement with Dern here, so maybe we're way off in left field, but a big-time opportunity for both of these fighters. Nonetheless, in a stacked strawweight division, big-time main card rolls on. You're not going to want to miss any of it. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Absolute banger. Coming up this weekend, we have the former title challenger. He rocked the champ, and we don't really see that very often. It is Gilbert Durinho Burns representing Sanford MMA. Is Kamaru Usman giving him some tips for this fight? He is.
All dominance, guys.
We have Khamzat Chimaev Bors making the return. This guy is the most dominant fighter that we currently have on the UFC's roster. Nobody has even given him an ounce of an issue, whether that be John Phillips, whether that be Gerald Mearsher, whether that be Li Jingliang. Any stop in between.
Reese McKee.
It hasn't really, well, see how he didn't mention Reese McKee because there wasn't a shred of an issue in that fight. But for Khamzat Chimaev, whether at 185 or at 170, I've never seen this dominant of a fighter make this big of a leap in competition and just continue to have success.
There's only one other guy I can think of. Justin Willis went from fighting Chase Sherman to Mark Hunt. I know that's a weird one, but you just said that and made me think of it. So that's the only other one I can think of, but you're 100% right.
Big, pretty, go home. But in this instance, for Chimaev, he's been cross-training. He's been working out in the States. He's been working out at All-Stars. He's had this weird budding bromance with Darren Till where Hamzat's ways of wrestling have hopefully rubbed off on Darren Till, and Darren Till's accent has rubbed off on Khamzat Chimaev. So it's an interesting fight, especially for the Florida crowd. And we've seen Gilbert Burns fight in Florida before. We've seen him make the trip from the Miami area, Miami adjacent area, over with Sanford up to Jacksonville in some fights. So for Burns, again, this is the craziest thing. He's a giant underdog. We all know this. You didn't come here not knowing that to watch this video. And if you didn't, he is. He's only lost four times. Once against Kamaru Usman. Once way back against Dan Hooker in 2018 where, listen, the weight cut wasn't going all that good, but he did lose that fight. He also lost to Michel Prezeris, the biggest guy ever, old Traktor. And he lost to Rashid Magomedov as well. Decision, or he got decision by Prezeris, finished by Hooker, and then the finish by Kamaru Usman.
Prezeris means way more in my MMA mind than I think anybody out there realizes. Prezeris out-wrestled Gilbert Burns, completely out-grappled him in their fight. These are known facts, you can go back and watch it. Gilbert Burns is one of the best grapplers in the world. These are another thing that is a proven fact we can all agree to. That's why it's kind of wild to me that Shavkat Rakhmonov was able to submit Prezeris and do it kind of easily. Like, this is why Prezeris, in my mind, means so much, because he was able to out-grapple a guy who I believe is one of the best grapplers in the UFC, but he also got submitted by a guy who I think is one of the brightest prospects, so that's why I have a lot of stock in Shavkat.
Fill in the gaps there. Prezeris, the long USADA suspension, then the suspension after the Rakhmonov fight.
Let me finish my story quick.
2 feet shorter.
I understand. I'm just saying, for the sake of bringing up Prezeris, he means a lot more in my mind than I think people realize. But that's the fight that I kept on going back to when I was trying to figure out what fights Gilbert Burns has had in his career that could help get him ready for the Chimaev fight. Because I feel like a lot of people look at this fight and think, wow, he fought Usman, that should get him ready for Chimaev. Not really, though, because Usman's a very interesting case. He has this, like, Hall of Fame-grade wrestling in his back pocket, but at least as of late, he has been a boxer in the majority of his fights. And I know the boxing gets opened up because the threat of the wrestling and, like, Usman's not genuinely a great boxer. He would not beat boxers in boxing. But because he's such a dominant wrestler, it opens up that part of his game. Shemaev's, not that he's the opposite side of that, but he relies on his wrestling a lot more. He can box and he can strike. Go back to the Gerald Meerschaert fight. Like, Gerald Meerschaert's got a really good chin. Tiago Santos hit him with a lot of shots before he knocked him out. Mahmud Muradov, who is one of the scariest men to be in the UFC octagon, hit him with overhand after overhand. And Gerald Meerschaert, like an old leather boot, just somehow able to withstand all that. Khamzat put him down with one shot, and that's the type of power he has. But when I go back and look at that Prezeris fight and the way he was able to control Burns on the ground, I do think that there's a world where Khamzat can just rinse and repeat, use his size, use his physicality, and not out-grapple Gilbert Burns per se. You know what I mean? Because that would say he's going to pass his guard and like really start to stunt on a guy who's truly one of the best grapplers in the UFC. I just think the size and the strength of Khamzat is at least going to make their grappling equal. Because that's the thing you got to go back to. Gilbert Burns was a lightweight. And I know the weight cut was tough for him. It was well documented how tough it was for him. But he didn't miss weight. And that is kind of another big thing. Like, if he had missed weight 17 times at lightweight, then okay, it makes sense. But him at 170, he's not a big guy. He does use his speed quite a bit at this weight class. And I do think that is going to pay off. Because again, if Khamzat has any negatives to his game, he's not the fastest striker in the world because of his size. So there's some gives and some takes with Hamzat's game. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens to Khamzat if Gilbert can crack him early, like he was able to do Usman. Because I think a lot of people look at this fight and think, okay, on the feet, Khamzat, he's big, he's got power. He can beat Gilbert on the feet. But, oh, what if Gilbert gets to the mat? Then it'll be the opposite. I think it's the other way around. I think Gilbert Burns is the much more dynamic fighter on the feet. He has kicks. He has much better variety even with his punches. But on the ground, I just think the physicality of Chimaev is going to be able to stifle whatever offense Burns tries to get off his back.
When you look at it for Chimaev, he has that Swedish national championship wrestling pedigree in his back pocket. Obviously, we all saw back late in 2021 that weird Jack Hermanson wrestling match because it was fun. But if you do look at it, Where does Jack Hermanson's bread get buttered? I mean, really, Shamayev was able to overtake him in that. Does it mean a lot? No, but it is interesting to see it nonetheless as an added piece of information that you can take and then relay it to this fight. And I look at Gilbert Burns and I look at some of the marquee wins, and I think the UFC's pumping this one quite a bit. It's that Mike Davis submission at 155, which Mike Davis, which he fought every other weekend. Remember his fight with Mason Jones? That was a lot of fun. Remember his fight against Thomas Gifford? That wasn't fun for Gifford. But a big win for Gilbert Burns there. Then he moves up to 170, fights Alexei Kuchenko, who had defenses, or good enough offensive wrestling with M1
Global. Is Kuchenko a poor man, Shamayev?
No, not really. Kuchenko was just bad in the UFC. But Burns grinds it out, gets the win there. He beats Gunnar Nelson, and he looked really good in that fight. He looked great against Damian Maia with the striking, the, you know, the Patrick Waugh, like we're putting our hands up, and then he just, you know, hammers away. He beats Tyron Woodley, complete performance. He did look very good in that fight. And then against Usman, he looked good at the start, and then the wheels started to fall off. It was a hot start, like Aljamain Sterling against Petr Yan. And then if you look at it against Wonderboy, people might go back and go, okay, he beat Wonderboy, and he grappled him. And he did. And it was pretty dominant.
Wasn't a good fight, though.
It was not a good fight, though. That's the big key to that one. It wasn't much fun. And Wonder Boy, it was always a matter of, was it a when or was it an if somebody's finally going to be able to just grind him out and wrestle him and beat him. And that's what Gilbert Burns was able to do. He's not going to do that against Khamzat Chimaev. He's not. I don't see him taking Chimaev down unless Chimaev absolutely blows his load in the first round and has no cardio to you know, no leg to stand on in a second round and a third round. That's when I could see Burns taking over. Burns, as compact as he is, as far as the gas tank is concerned, I'm not necessarily worried about it at 170, especially against a guy like Chimaev, who we've seen finish fights incredibly and incredibly quickly.
Well, so Burns got stronger as the Woodley fight went on, and his work rate went through the roof. Because early on, he was more of a power puncher in that matchup, and then as the fight went on, he was using great volume, great combinations. And again, this fight to me, I think everybody thinks Khamzat's going to win. Again, the odds aren't what they are if people thought Burns had a really good chance to win. But the thing about Chimaev is that he's going to have to show us more than like a 30-second clip in this fight for us to really have a good idea how he would do against someone like Usman. Because right now, Usman is the only champion currently fighting in the UFC. There's a real chance to become the GOAT of his division. We're about to talk about Petr Yan and Aljamain Sterling. Maybe you think one of those two have that ability. And same thing with Volkanovski and or a Korean Zombie if he's able to win. But for Chimaev, there's still so many questions that even if you are his biggest fan, you still almost want Gilbert Burns to have a couple moments in this fight just to see how Chimaev reacts when he is on the receiving end of damage, or if he's the one getting taken down. That's what I would like to see.
Odds open at par. Chimaev now a -543. Average on best fight odds for Burns, +395 on the comeback. Tapology vote surprise to us, as they are to you. Matt, I'm going to say over under 85% Chimaev.
Over.
You're going to say it's over? It's slightly over. Look at that. 1,898 total votes, 86% Chimaev. 8% by decision, 13% by submission, 73% by knockout. For the 14% that have Gilbert Burns, it's like one of those lifesaver popsicles. 40% decision, 30% submission, and the rest by knockout. Matt, again, it's one of those ones. I think it's tougher than the odds suggest because, again, the sample size of Chimaev against, you know, top 5 guys, top 10 guys even, it's not quite there. I have Khamzat Chimaev winning with the physicality, but once more, this is the most dynamic guy that Chimaev's ever fought.
Okay, I think Chimaev's going to win, but this is not hot take time. Who do you think of the top 5 gives him the hardest matchup, though, other than the champ? Like, for me, I think Leon Edwards is a really hard matchup for him because he can keep distance. He's not the, like, craziest guy to where he gets on the inside and he'll just start winging bombs. He's someone who can stay technical throughout a really long fight. So that's sort of who I think of as to a guy who's in the top 5 and is established, who might be able to give Chimaev a tough fight. Like, you didn't get time to prepare for this. I'm just curious, like, who do you think could give him a tough fight before he fights Usman?
Covington, we've seen get hit and cracked against Usman, hit and cracked against Masvidal's last time out there. But, again, when it comes to wrestling being such a good game of Chimaev and the fact that Covington has cardio, he could fight 15 rounds in MMA and just wrestle, and he'd still be fresh. So, for that reason, I would say Covington, the champ, Edwards. But then, when you look at the rest of the guys, it's tough.
You know me, though. I want Shavkat Rakhmonov to fight Khamzat Chimaev. I genuinely think they're in the same, like, tier. I just think they haven't had the chance to, like, show it against these top-level fighters. I have people tell me I'm crazy in my Twitter DMs because I said this, like, a while ago. And then Shavkat, thank God, beat Carlson Harris. But, like, Shavkat and Chimaev, they just need the chance to show how good they are. I think we all kind of understand just how talented of a fighter they are. They just need the experience to sort of catch up. So I think this could be a great fight because we're going to learn something about Khamzat Chimaev this weekend.
Big time opportunity for both of these guys. Let us know down below in the comments section if you think the odds are baked on Khamzat Chimaev. I do. But both of us going with Sweden's own Chimaev in this fight. Big time opportunity for both of these guys to springboard for Burns, maybe into another title shot for Chimaev. Maybe he's able to surpass everybody that's ahead of him in that line and get that opportunity next. It'll be an interesting one nonetheless. And the two title fights left on the card that you're not going to want to miss. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Like on Xbox Original, you were waiting for Halo 2. We get Aljamain Sterling and Petr Yan 2, and I hope it's as good as that video game was way back when, all those years ago. Because the first fight between Sterling and Yan, obviously, it ended due to controversy. It was just over a year ago. Sterling, your champ, he wears the belt. People are upset that he shouldn't wear the belt, but he finally goes back and he's able to nurse those old injuries. And we look at it for Aljamain Sterling. He's always had that college pedigree of wrestling in his back pocket. In certain fights, he uses it. In certain fights, he doesn't need to because he's just so damn crisp when it comes to his striking. And for Aljamain Sterling, as low as people might be on him, and as nasty as people might get in the comment section under this video, the guy's 20-3, and he's only ever lost to really, really good level of competition. And you look at it for Aljamain Sterling.
Brian Caraway?
Even the five on in. Cody Stamann, Jimmy Rivera, Pedro Munhoz, Corey Sandhagen, and the Petr Yan fight. We just continue to get better with that level of competition. Sterling's been adjacent to the top 15 for a very, very long time. Whereas for Petr Yan, former champ over with ACB. We started the channel off in 2018 with Fight Night Picks talking about guys like Askar Askarov and Petr Yan finally getting their opportunity in the UFC. And for Yan, he's had certain fights where he's been tested a little bit. Like, we've had those little tweaks. John Dodson able to do his magician-type stuff and, crack Yan on a couple of occasions. The crazy fight that Petr Yan had against Jinsu San. Hell, even Petr Yan's fight that he had to take in the meantime against Corey Sandhagen. Wild fight. Really love to see it. But if you look at it for Petr Yan, switch things up once more. He's gone back over to Tiger Muay Thai to get ready for this camp. And it's things that you absolutely love to see out of him. For Yan, even in the other loss that he had, consider it. He has a close fight against Magomed Magomedov that he loses. And then he goes back into the next one, and it's like a fury rising, a phoenix rising. He went absolutely balls to the wall in that fight. Just think of what you're going to get in the second Sterling fight.
I truly believe Petr Yan is the number one pound-for-pound fighter in the world. If you just break down everybody in the UFC skill set, I truly believe Petr Yan right now is the most skilled fighter. And I know there's other fighters. Like, Alexander Volkanovski is a very good claim to that, too. He's going to be in the main event this weekend. But just think about what Petr Yan does and break down his strengths and his weaknesses. Let's start with his weaknesses. Perfect. Now let's go to his strengths. He's an incredible boxer. He can go to the body. He has great power, great output. He's very good defensively. And he's someone who doesn't get too excited when he does hurt his opponent or if he's just having good success overall. He's very, very patient. And that's the thing with Petr Yan. He's one of the smartest MMA fighters out there. And I feel like that's something that doesn't get talked about enough. MMA fighters have to be so effing smart when they're in fights at this level fighting for titles. Petr Yan's fighting a guy who submitted the last guy he fought in like a minute and a half. That's how dangerous Aljamain Sterling is. Oh, and did I mention he can throw hundreds of punches every single round? Like, Sterling didn't get to a title shot by accident. He didn't just, you know, he wasn't the short notice replacement for like three fights and Dana White wanted to give him a favor. Like, he beat Corey Sandhagen and it basically, like, it wasn't even hard for him to do. Corey Sandhagen, who just had a fight of the year with Petr Yan. Like, Aljamain's win streak really doesn't get the credit that it does deserve. But let's put that to the side. Let's just break down their first fight really quick. Aljamain wasn't having a lot of success in that fight. And I know some people want to point to numbers in that fight and say, oh, well, he was landing a lot of volume. If you go back and watch that fight, he doesn't land clean enough on Petr Yan to really get his respect on the feet. And I think that's a big issue for him. Because if you're not able to hurt Yan, if you're not able to stun him or crack him on the feet, he can maintain a very, very high guard for the whole entire fight.
The trouble for Sterling, and he did have success at the start of that fight. He definitely did. He was able to win. You know, we're talking in terms of rounds. He was able to get it done with his volume. But he wasn't all the way in with his striking.
Because you can win a battle and then you can try to win the war. And for Petr Yan, he's thinking about the big picture overall. He knows that he can get stronger as the fight goes on. Like, Corey Sandhagen had success too early on. But this is the difference between Sandhagen and Sterling and just their overall striking style. Corey Sandhagen will stay patient and he will explode when he thinks he has an opening to explode. My issue with the striking style of Aljamain Sterling is a positive, but it's a negative. He gives you everything at once. There's no secrets after that first round, because when you're someone like Aljo, who throws 100, 150 strikes a round, you're going to run out of jabs and straight right hands to throw at a certain point. And with Aljo, he's just always doing something a la Clay Guida. Well, with someone like Petr Yan, whose whole game plan is, wait until you show me everything, and then I've got your reads, I just don't think it's a great game plan, and we did see that against Yan in their first fight. Yes, Sterling was able to get numbers up, but all of that does help Petr Yan in the grand scheme of things. The more openings that you show him, he's just going to get his own striking down a little bit closer and a little bit closer. And from midway through the second round on in their fight, Yan would make Sterling pay with power shots for every time Sterling would step in the pocket. And that's the big difference between these two guys. Sterling can hit Yan 20 times and there might not be an effect. If Yan hits Sterling one time clean, he's going to put him down.
And we saw how that played out in that first fight. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're watching this fight and I bet every guy in that ATT corner is going to have in the back of their mind, don't throw that knee, especially when it's between rounds. Don't throw that knee, don't do it. You know exactly what you need not to do. Don't throw that knee. Even just from the corner, don't throw that knee. The whole crowd, maybe they'll yell in unison. Somebody will have a Bristol board where they wrote, don't throw that knee. They bought it at the Dollar Tree. Not rhyme. But Matt, when I do look at this one, you look at Petr Yan and you can really kind of compare him to a lot of different boxers. Obviously, boxing is the main tool that you see. You will see a little bit of wrestling. He can mix it up there. I don't expect it necessarily against
the
guy.
He took down Aljo a lot in their first fight.
I don't necessarily see it just in this one. But the weirdest part about this overall fight, Aljamain Sterling, no Matt Serra. We're fighting out of Longo and Weidman MMA. No Matt Serra in the corner. So we'll have Ray Longo. He'll have Ally Quintel. He'll have Marab in the corner. But no Serra. That's a big, big point. It was a point after that fight. It's been a point, and now it's going to flare back up as this fight week goes on. But with Petr Yan, the big comparison where I was going with his boxing is you're going to hear, you know, and I made the comparison with the Floyd Mayweather of downloading an opponent's game plan. But even like a guy like Canelo Alvarez, he does the exact same
thing. Terrence Crawford is the perfect example because they can both fight from both stances.
Both stances, download a game plan, continue on. And then like Canelo against Billy Joe Saunders. Like, once we've really figured this one out, we're going to break this guy's face. So for Petr Yan, another big-time opportunity in the rematch. For Aljamain Sterling, though, it's almost a bigger opportunity because for Yan, he was able to go out. He fought Corey Sandhagen, an all-time fight of the year fight, win that interim gold, and then just rebook his shot, which you already would have thought would have been rebooked. But Sterling needed time to repair and recuperate from the surgery, the injuries that he's had, you know, kind of an accumulation of damage throughout his career. For Sterling, though, he gets to gain your respect, my respect, everybody else's respect. And I've kept it for Sterling. I don't read into much of the stuff. I know a lot of people like to get hyped and hurt about what he says in the media. He's having a fun time with it, if you haven't realized. But the odds for this one, you don't often see the defending champion open a plus 285, now at a plus 350, but you have it this time. And for Petr Yan, open a minus 350, minus 467. We'll open it up to the YouTube community tab, Matt, but I'll let you first kind of digest those odds here.
They make 100% sense to me. Did anybody who watched that first fight think that Aljo was on his way to winning before Petr Yan landed that knee? No one? Perfect. Like, yes, he had some success with his volume early, but this is the big difference. Aljo can throw strikes, but there's not an accumulation of damage behind them. When Vicente Luque throws strikes, there is a big difference between what that guy looks like in the first round to the third round. Their face is messed up, they have a lot of swelling, there's open cuts. With Aljo, it's a lot of pitter-patter, you get frustrated with my pitter-patter, you shoot on me, I submit you. That's sort of the progression of his game. Petr Yan took him down multiple times in their first fight, and there was zero threat of Yan getting submitted. That's how good of a grappler Petr Yan is, and he's a way better boxer than he is a grappler. That's why at the start when I said let's break down Petr Yan's weaknesses and strengths, I didn't spend a lot of time on weaknesses, because if we are being honest, okay, he's not a great offensive submission fighter. That's fine. You don't have to be when you're as good as he is with your ground and pound and with your wrestling. And I just... For Aljamain Sterling to be as good as he is, and me finding it this hard to find a way for him to win, just sort of speaks to how good Petr Yan is. I truly do think Petr Yan, if he is able to win this fight against Aljo, I look at him as being the most likely to knock off Dominic Cruz, as eventually getting that title of who the greatest bantamweight of all time is at the UFC level.
1,600 total votes, 84% going with Petr Yan. In the comments section in the YouTube community tab, DrewCliff82 saying, I think Yan gets it, but I think it will be more competitive than the last one. Some people seem to forget the first two rounds the last fight were competitive. Yan won them, of course, but they were competitive. We also have Yan by legal knee this time. We also have AG saying, I wish I could have got the minus 115 on Yan like the first matchup. Owen Sweet saying, yawn by soccer kick and way back up to the top. Bo said, I wonder if Sterling is going to change the game plan from the first fight. It seemed like he was trying to put as much pressure as he could on Yawn. But Yawn was able to make his reads and Sterling was gassing out. And that is a big deal, especially in that first fight. Whereas Yawn's one of those guys that builds up as the fight goes on. Sterling fights with a high pace. But in a 5-round fight, we'll see how he's able to, you know, kind of withstand that. So maybe feel like Aljamain Sterling, it's early, but we already saw those early reads in his first fight against Petr Yan. Not to say that it's not possible, because Aljamain Sterling, premier fighter in this division. Do not forget that. Like, a lot of people are just going emotion only in this fight, but trying to use logic to prevail. I mean, Petr Yan, again, what I saw from this guy out of ACB in the revenge rematch against Magomed Magomedov, then to come into the UFC, and yes, some of those fights, maybe they're a little more competitive than you want or whatever. Maybe they're too much fun, and you expect more out of Petr Yan. But the Jinsu Sun fight, the John Dodson fight, I give you the Uriah Faber fight, like,
exactly,
as a counter to that. So, realistically for me, or the Jose Aldo fight, where it was pretty much one-way traffic. And look at how Jose Aldo's looked at 135 even since that fight. So, for me, yeah, I like Petr Yan in this fight, and I don't see a big difference out of the, you know, the last one to this one here.
Interesting note that Khamzat Chimaev spent a little bit of time training with Petr Yan during this training camp. Wasn't there for a long time, but I thought that was really interesting.
For a good time.
Exactly. So have a good time, because the sun can't shine every day. I just think Petr Yan doesn't really have any weaknesses in his game to where Aljo can overtake them. Like, Aljo, more likely than not, is probably going to win this fight by submission if he is going to win. And for him to win it by submission, he's going to have to require Yan to probably go for a finish early, overexert himself, and then fight in an uncharacteristic Petr Yan way for another 20 minutes. I just don't expect all those things to break right for Aljo. I think Petr Yan is the much more powerful striker. He's the much more technical striker. And this is the last thing. I know he got hit by John Dodson. This is the only guy who's hit him clean in the UFC. Like, Jose Aldo landed a few leg kicks, but with his boxing, he had little to no success whatsoever. And even against Corey Sandhagen, that fight was really good. But defensively, Petr Yan's so good at parrying shots in tight that he's not going out there getting hit clean, even though he is getting into some crazy fights in the UFC. So I'm not worried about Yan and, oh, is his durability going to completely fade away in this fight? So I do like Petr Yan in this matchup, but the bantamweight division is on fire right now.
Bantamweight and Fuego right up there near the tippity top of my list on the last episode of Early Stoppage when we ranked the division. So go check out the podcast on the channel. Big time opportunity for both of these guys, both of us going with the interim champ, No Mercy, Petr Yan. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Keep filling up and checking out that YouTube community tab. And the last thing that I have for you, if you haven't checked it out already, all of this is a podcast. It's on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Rate and review. We never get to hear from anybody in the comments over there. And if we do start hearing from people over there, well, we'll start talking about it on the show as well. So check out the podcast if you haven't already. We definitely appreciate everybody's support, and we have a big time main event for gold at 145 between Alexander Volkanovski and the man himself, the Korean Zombie, that you're not going to want to miss. So check it out. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. Big time fight in our main event for UFC 273. It's Alexander the Great Volkanovski looking to defend his belt, taking on the Korean Zombie Chan Sung Jung, a man who years and years and years ago took on Jose Aldo way back when for that featherweight crown. He was unable to get the win in that fight. Obviously, the shoulder popped out. He ends up getting finished in that one. But for Chan Sung Jung, it's been a wild road back into the UFC. He had his mandatory military service over in Korea. He comes back, he ends up having the fight against Dennis Bermudez that definitely goes his way, and it's back off to the races. He ends up losing to Yair Rodriguez in a fight he was winning until the dying second. That crazy, crazy elbow up the top. He beats Hinata Moicano. He beats Frankie Edgar. He loses to Brian Ortega, and he beats Dan Ige his last time out, that fight back in June of last year. The Ige main event, where he was actually a slight underdog in that fight, able to get the win against 50K Dan Ige. So Matt, for the Korean Zombie, he's really jumping the line of contenders in this opportunity. I mean, again, the aforementioned Yair Rodriguez, we've got Max Holloway, who's just able to get the win over him, but we don't want a third iteration of Volkanovski Holloway at this current juncture. There are a lot
of
sharks.
Well, no, that was originally planned, but Chan Sung-jung took this fight on short notice.
There are a lot of sharks in that water is where I was going, but they ended up going with the Korean Zombie. A great decision, because he is an all-action fighter if we've ever seen one. We see it in the countdown for this week where, you know, Chan Sung Jung kind of alludes to the fact that I was that zombie in my first run in the UFC. But since then, I've really tightened things up, Going over to the team at Fight Ready, Santino DeFranco, Eddie Cha, and crew, Cejudo's there, Prochazka's there, John Jones is there, everybody's there now, Vanessa Demopoulos is there even. But when we look at it for him, he really has dialed down the wildness, turned up the technician, and the only fight that I've really seen out of Chan Sung Jung in the second run in the UFC where I kind of question it was the fight against Brian Ortega.
Wait, you mean where he did look wild and not technical? That's what I kind of disagree with that point about him refining his skill set. He very much is the same fighter he was. It's just his durability is not at that same level.
Yeah.
And it's weird, too, because Chan Sung Jung has a knockout loss to George Roop, a guy who could walk into your house right now and you'd have no idea who he is.
Roop? Is that him?
Exactly. But it was like a crazy knockout where he flicks the leg over the shoulder. It's a really, really wild shot. And from that moment on, you didn't really know what you were going to get with Zombie. You kind of knew, okay, he's an exciting fighter, but is he a good fighter? Then he was able to have that really nice win over Leonard Garcia, because that's what people forget. He has one of the all-time great fights with Leonard Garcia back in WEC, and then they ended up having the rematch in the UFC, where, of course, he gets that beautiful twister that was the first... for the longest time, and healed that record for years and years and years till Bryce Mitchell came along and was able to get his own twister. But Chan Sung Jung is an interesting fighter because he is kind of living proof that you don't have to be good, you have to be exciting. And that's very disrespectful to what Korean Zombie is because he is very, very good. But when you look at his record, it's not the record of someone who should be fighting for the title right now. And that's the other thing. He is taking this fight on 6 weeks' notice. I know that's not crazy short notice, but for normally for a championship caliber camp, you're doing 10 to 8 weeks. Normally it's 8 weeks, and then if champs want to add that 2 extra weeks on, that's what they'll do. I do worry a little bit about Chan Sung Jung with a slightly limited camp because, again, when you're fighting for championships at the UFC level, any small little hitch can really make a big difference. So I do think that that's something that we should at least bring up because, again, Max Holloway was originally scheduled to be fighting Alexander Volkanovski this weekend. He had that shin injury, knee injury, gets taken off of the fight card, and then all of a sudden, medically, now Max Holloway is able to fight. That was really weird, and that's why the odds are where they are. Like, for the Korean Zombie, I do think there is a way for him to win this fight. It's just extremely streamlined, because for Volkanovski, what is he not good at? He's another one of these guys who doesn't have any glaring weakness in his game, but if he has had any hole, it's that up-the-middle shots can sometimes attack him. He's a shorter guy who does duck a lot in his fights because the threat of the takedown is so prevalent with his offensive game, and he will find himself ducking into knees and uppercuts up the middle. Chan Sung Jung has some of the best uppercuts really in MMA, I would say. He's really sneaky with them. He has long arms and deceiving power, so I do think that that is an area he could take advantage of with Volkanovski. But it's very hard for me to sit here and say, I think the Korean Zombie is going to land an uppercut in the fourth round to beat Volk. That's a tough tell.
Okay, so let's go with prevailing storylines from this week, because this is what the UFC is selling you, and this is what everybody on Twitter is going to sell you. Korean Zombie, wild fighter, knockout ability, could he beat Alexander Volkanovski? For Alexander Volkanovski, he's got that championship medal, and we saw that tested in his last fight. And then the UFC goes into a promo of Volkanovski swimming in murky water, and then sharks, but not near Volkanovski, but also in murky water. So maybe he's also swimming with the sharks. And we saw that in his last fight. And I'm not going to beleaguer the point of the Brian Ortega fight, but we saw Brian Ortega get in the Ortega zone. And then Alexander Volkanovski get out of the Ortega zone and then pour it on Ortega.
You've got mad at me on a few fight companions because, like, Amanda Nunes kind of gave up in her last fight. Let's all just be very honest about it. Volkanovski has none of that in him. Like, you need to have him unconscious, rocked in a full rear naked choke where he has zero cardio left for him to give up in a fight. Like, that's what that proved against Brian Ortega. He ate big shots in the feet, and Brian Ortega is a pretty good striker. I know that's, it's kind of weird to think about Brian Ortega now.
Because Brian Ortega had the long layoff, then he fought Korean Zombie. You didn't know what you were going to get because Ortega's a great grappler, but Korean Zombie has good takedown defense, so what are we going to get? And then Brian Ortega had that fight where he leveled up his striking, and Korean Zombie just kind of got caught.
And Ortega carried that striking upgrade into the Volkanovski fight. So Volkanovski was able to eat big shots from a very heavy-handed puncher in Brian Ortega, get out of his two best submissions, being the guillotine and the triangle choke, and also still be a good enough grappler to not immediately get back up to your feet and let him off the hook. Realize that, okay, my opponent's tired too because he just burned himself out going for all of these submission attempts. Now is my time to put some damage on him. Those aren't just skill sets at their highest peak. That's a fighter who's constantly thinking while he's in the cage too, and that's sort of the overall X factor of Volkanovski. Is he the flashiest striker? No. Although skill-wise, he is as skilled of a striker as there is. Is he the best wrestler? No. Does he have the best cardio? He's up there, but probably not. Is he the smartest fighter? I would argue he is up there, though, for in-fight IQ. He doesn't put himself into compromising positions unless his opponent's really able to put him in one. And that's why I do think Volkanovski's got a great chance to win against the zombie.
And when you compare Volkanovski, and let's talk about some tight positions that he's been in, because again, those Holloway wins, those were controversial somewhat. And then if you look at it, in his fight against Ortega, he was in that bad spot early. And then you look at the two guys at the end of the fight, and yeah, Volkanovski's got some cuts and some blemishes. Ortega looks like a pincushion, if there ever were one. So when you do look at it, I mean, for Chan Sung Jung, he is able to out-grapple poor grapplers. I know, again, the twister against Leonard Garcia in their second fight. But the craziest part about Korean Zombie, he has his own takedowns, too. Like, he can get himself to that position. He doesn't just have to knock you down, which you would assume. And in his fight against Dan Ige, he even had success in the wrestling, where that's a portion of Ige's game that he prides himself on out of Extreme Couture.
And I guess that's my question for you. So we both agree, he didn't look very good against Brian Ortega whatsoever.
He looked flat.
Exactly. And he had a really good rebound performance against Dan Ige. Was there any one thing in that Ige fight that you think he can carry over to this Volkanovski matchup?
That's the real thing. I mean, you consider it for Ige and the opponent. Again, you get a big win over Gavin Tucker, and then we end up with Korean Zombie. Like, we're here, and then we're here. And then for Korean Zombie, you beat Dan Ige, who's here, and then you go way up there with Alexander Volkanovski. Like, I don't see him having success with the wrestling against Volkanovski, because if I thought anybody was going to have success against Volkanovski in the wrestling, I would have assumed, I almost tossed out an F-bomb, but I would consider, like, JBC, Junior Bacon Cheeseburger, Jeremy Kennedy. If Jeremy Kennedy, that's the part of his game, well, he didn't have success in it. Volkanovski pounded him out. Okay, maybe even Chad Mendes. Well, that didn't happen in that fight. So, again, if those guys didn't have success, I've seen Volkanovski fight volume strikers. I've seen him fight power punchers. I've seen him fight high-level grapplers. I've seen him fight wrestlers. He's run the gamut. Alexander Volkanovski's rise to the title wasn't like these hand-picked opponents. Like, he fought the creme de la creme. Hell, he even fought Jose Aldo, if you want to round it out. So for me, with Volkanovski, those guys couldn't beat him at this point in his career. 33, you're past the 31-32 of like the pinnacle, but he's still right there at 23-1. I have a hard time picking against Volkanovski, not even looking at the odds and the Tapology votes.
I agree 100%. I am glad that you brought up his age, though, because this is the last thing we're going to mention about Volkanovski. He's been hurt a number of times in his last five fights. Chad Mendes dropped him in the first fight. I guess they only had one fight, but Chad Mendes dropped him. Max Holloway hurt him twice in their second fight with up the middle shots. And Brian Ortega didn't drop him before the guillotine. But I gotta be honest, I kind of think he hurt him with the right hand when he catches the kick and he falls down. I think he kind of got wobbled by that shot too when Ortega falls into the guillotine. Again, just because I'm saying it doesn't mean I'm right. But I do think he was hurt on the feet in that fight at least one time. So, like you said, he's 33, which doesn't mean you're past your prime by any means, but we're starting to ask those questions right now. And we have seen him get hurt a few times in his last few fights. If Zombie is able to put a big uppercut up the middle in the first round, he could hurt Volkanovski. But again, other than that one very specific method of victory, I do like the overall well-roundedness of Alexander Volkanovski.
Volkanovski open to -330 favorite, -750 right now for TKZ. Open to +265, he's +505. We go to the phones. We go over to the YouTube community tab, and over there, 1,900 total votes, 85% Volkanovski in the comments section. Devin says, as much as I want Korean Zombie to win and end his career having won the belt, I think Volk is going to easily win by unanimous decision. We also have Bill, who's saying, like the promo says, TKZ is a lethal weapon. If you can't figure out a striking, you're going to be in for a war, and you're taking a ton of damage. Ortega was able to figure it out, made TKZ look kind of flat in their fight. I think Volkanovski will be able to find the holes, too. But I expect this one to be way closer than the odds suggest.
I like that breakdown.
And for Mike, Mike says, I don't even give TKZ a puncher's chance. To be honest, Ortega beat the brakes off TKZ, which earned Ortega an even worse whooping at the hands of Volkanovski. Volkanovski has the advantage standing, grappling, and in the first round, the fifth round, and by decision, Volkanovski's beat two of three guys Korean Zombie lost to in the UFC. I would, the Aldo one, that was a while ago, but it does count. And beat Max Holloway twice in between doing so. If he wins, my mind will be blown. MMA math works when it's this clear cut. So, yeah, I mean, for me, I have Alexander Volkanovski for all the points that I made earlier. But, Matt, this is going to be one of those fights that's featured awesome. On Saturday with the Fight Night Pick Sidekick. What's that about now?
So here's the thing. If you guys have been following this channel for a while, you know that whether it's a fight night or a pay-per-view card, we get on 2 hours before the card starts, and we give you one last chance to sort of go through the card if there was any weight miss, if someone looked bad on the scales.
Something crazy happened throughout the week.
Exactly. Any little tidbits of news that we can share with you guys as I hit my head on the stage behind us, that's what we try to do and share it with you. But like you had mentioned, this isn't any weekend. This is a pay-per-view weekend. So 15 minutes before the pay-per-view card starts, we are ready. We do a... I'll let you say the name of it because I almost called it the fight companion again. It's the fight sidekick?
I mean, Matt, you gotta have the preparation involved. The fight night picks sidekick.
There we go.
We have question mark kicks, we have sidekicks, and hey, maybe like Cage Warriors, eventually we'll have a hook kick. I don't know.
Perhaps.
Maybe we'll see what happens. But we have the fight night picks sidekick. It's gonna take place. You saw me do it, but it's gonna take place coming up on Saturday, 15 minutes before that main card. We hang out with you, we offer commentary, we answer your questions. It's one of the most fun things that we do with this channel, so make sure you check it out. If you haven't tossed a like, really drive that video up throughout the week. I went ham making that graphic for this week with the neon, so that was a lot of fun, and I certainly appreciate all the support that we felt into 2021. It's been a wild year already for Fight Night Picks, and it's thanks to you folks out there. So subscribe so you know when we go live on Saturday, and make sure you toss that like. It means a lot to us. Thank you so much. Hopefully you enjoy the fight week. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.